conversation that we've had in the last hour, just calmly with interacting with one another, asking our questions, learning about our traditions, etc. This is what I consider to be healthy dialogue. It puts us all in a better position to understand one another better.
And now I want to ask you a favor. My show is ending, but the show that follows, which is Bob Kincaid's show, he would like to continue this discussion if you have some time to do so. I've actually kept my listeners at bay because I wanted to get our discussion out there. They have some calls. Do you have some more time to spend with me, or are you done for the
hour? No, I could probably hang around for about a half hour.
Okay. All right. Let's conclude this show of the Inside Scoop. Let's give Bob a chance to rev up his show and also give listeners and Bob a chance to question our guest. We'll be right back after this, but for now, this is the end of the Inside Scoop. Thank you all for listening.
Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A little bit of a different beginning to the program this evening. I am, of course, Bob, you know that. This is our little sandbox for cussing and discussing for 3 hours a night. And this is also a prime example of the beauty of our reinvention of the medium, what we love to term conversation radio, a fascinating, utterly fascinating discussion going on at this point in time for the last hour between Mark Levine and Daryl Bach, Christian theologian from Texas, time proved just a little bit too short to get done what we wanted to get done, and Mark kindly invited me to share in the discussion with Dr. Bach. Dr. Bach, thank you very kindly for staying over. We sincerely appreciate it. I'm Bob.
It's my pleasure, Bob, and I wish you a great holiday season.
Well, thank you, and to you as well. Mark and I... Mark and I have a tradition, and he's still on the line, by the way, these sorts of things happening, because Mark and I come from very different backgrounds. Mark is Jewish. I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. And as such, we've had some fascinating conversations. He mentioned the conversation we had with his rabbi. He invited me into that as well. And I can tell you that the audience, our friends, the people who share their time with us to listen to these programs, find it equally fascinating. So we really do appreciate your time, and I wish you a very joyous holiday season as well. Let me, if I may, run sort of to the heart of the matter, since the conversations are being conducted during the holiday season, and I'm just I don't see any way but to ask it bluntly: do you get in line with this whole war on Christmas thing?
Well, I think our best description would be I'm pretty schizophrenic about it. There are parts of it that strike me as being ludicrous. And what I mean by that is that, when we can't wish each other a happy holiday season that's appropriate to the person's background that, people have, and we just try to genericize it all, I actually think that communicates a terrific disrespect to the various religious traditions that are represented. And so it seems to me I ought to be perfectly comfortable wishing someone a happy Hanukkah or a happy Kwanzaa or whatever the holiday is, and not have that be offensive to some. I mean, if someone is an atheist and doesn't believe in any of that, then, you know, have a happy holiday. And some of the forms of political correctness, it seems to me, actually don't help us communicate with one another, because what they do is they take away the ability to have the kinds of conversations that you all have so generously allowed in the last hour. And I actually think it's beneficial to be able to have those kinds of conversations, provided we can do so in a fairly rational and calm kind of way, in which we really are, you know, trying to come to some degree of understanding. We obviously won't come necessarily to agreement on everything, but at least we can come to an understanding about why the world is the way it is and why the views exist as they do.
And I'm absolutely fascinated by the history of Christianity. It's a little bit personal, but, you know, some of the best grades I ever pulled down in school were the theology classes. It's the kind of stuff you can really wrap your mind around, and it will really, really engage you. And, you know, I have children. We've got a rather large family, and I try to answer questions as rationally as I possibly can. And my 10-year-old came home the other day, telling me that she had been castigated by a fundamentalist child who told her that she was going to hell if she didn't understand that Jesus was actually born on December 25th. And, you know, obviously she got this, you know, from her parents. It all begins in the home. She got it at church, things like that. But we do understand, do we not? I mean, it's a point of agreement that this is, you know, this is entirely a ceremonial date, right?
The actual December 25th date is absolutely an entirely ceremonial date. The best that I can tell, it goes back to being a Christian equivalent for a holiday that was known as Saturnalia, and which was a Greco-Roman holiday, and it was designed to be a Christian replacement and a Christian equivalent for that.
Because people, you know, this is a nice time of year to take a break. But yeah, Saturnalia and all the other religions.
The winter solstice, of course.
Yeah, that were centered on the winter solstice. Mm-hmm. With that in mind. I was obviously producing Mark's show while you were carrying on your conversation, Doctor. I think one of the problems I have is that, knowing as I do a little bit about the origins of the Gospels and the origins of the letters of St. Paul, we know how far removed they are, and we also understand that these are advocacy documents. And so they can't be taken as pure history. Is there any way to really find, and frankly, I hold the agnostic, atheistic side of this as much to be criticized as the believer side. Is there really any sense in trying to talk about a historical Jesus?
Well, I certainly think there is. I think that you can look at you can extract out a lot of the stuff that gets debated, okay, which leaves you with the stuff where there may be some consensus, and you still can work your way pretty far back into this discussion. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. With regard to the Pauline epistles, okay, these are the earliest New Testament documents that we have. There is virtually universal agreement that four of these go back to Paul, whatever you say about the rest of them. So that's Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Galatians. Those four letters tell us an awful lot about the nature of early Christianity, and they cover the period from probably the late 40s into the early 60s. So we're within 15 years to 25 years of the Christian event, of the Christ, of Jesus walking the earth. Let me say it that way. And in these materials are embedded summaries, doctrinal summaries of what it is that the church was teaching. So I'm not going to take the whole epistle. I'm just going to take the portions where it says, we're passing on to you the tradition of what it is that we teach. Or I'm going to give you a summary of the religious rites that we observe in our church services, baptism and the Lord's Supper, which also are coming down by tradition. And which means these materials are older than the actual dates of the letters themselves, not to mention the biographical experience of Paul himself when he became a Christian. All that, you put that all together, and you can get your hands around what I would say the core of Christianity is all about historically, and you're back into a period that takes you into the 30s, okay? You're in the very same decade when Jesus walked the earth, because that's when Paul was converted. And he has some autobiographical remarks in these letters. So this takes us a long way back. Now, this is the kind of stuff that most people discussing Christianity and the history of Christianity don't discuss or ignore. And in the process, it seems, we end up with a historical distortion on the portrait of Christianity, because these materials and the way I'm citing them have nothing to do with the citation that says this material is the Word of God. I'm just simply looking at them for their historical value as historical documents. Yes, there's advocacy in it, but as we said, every religious position has advocacy in it, and then you got to sort through the nature of what is being advocated. And, of course, the last hour's discussion was part of what we were engaged in doing that.
Do you could see, and I'm coming in here, Bob, if that's okay with you.
Jump right in.
Dr. Bach, I mean, do you concede that this is, I guess, just a difference of point of view, that it could very well be that Jesus was a man who lived and died in the context of his day, who taught and mixed, you know, we talked about the fact that there were a lot of different philosophies going on at this time, Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, the Qumran community, the Greeks, the Romans. It was a very difficult time. You know, they're building the Second Temple. There's about to be a revolt where the whole thing's going to come crashing down. It's a time full of lots of ideas. And that Jesus was a guy at that time who had many of these ideas and propounded some of them and died a revolutionary, crucified like so many. And that's his story. I mean, there's no proof Jesus
here's
is God.
The,
is there?
The
no historical
here's
proof.
The, here's the problem with the scenario that you're talking about, okay? The scenario that you're talking about is no one's portrait of Jesus from the materials that we have from that time, neither the portrait of those who supported him, nor the portrait of his opponents. So I look back and I go, this
doesn't make it not true.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
if you have an event.
Well, but let me.
I mean, I'm a lawyer by trade. I know that if an event happens, okay, and one side claims it's all this stuff, and then the other side claims, no, it's all this other stuff. Oftentimes the event is somewhere in the middle, even if neither side is claiming it. And, in fact, that's what a jury has to figure out in a courtroom. You know, one side says it's all my fault, all the other guy's fault. The other one says, well, it's all the other guy's fault. And then usually it's kind of a bit of both fault. So just because both sides, you know, take it in different directions doesn't mean the truth is somewhere in the middle.
But there's a terrific consistency in the nature of the conflict that's being portrayed on both sides. This is not a case. This is a case of a different judgment being made about what happened, okay, or what's going on, but that judgment is not rotating around different ideas about what's being claimed. It's a different judgment about the claim. So that's different than the kind of situation I think you're talking about, generally speaking, in a law court. And so when I look at this, I go, you know, either Jesus' followers really messed up on who he was, having spent some time with him, okay, and their claims for him were so exaggerated that it doesn't reflect his person at all. Okay, I find that very hard to accept on the one hand, especially when on the other side the claim is coming down that those kinds of claims were precisely what had them upset. And so in that sense, go ahead.
I just say I don't think you have to argue the Gospels are 100% true or 100% false.
I have said nothing in the last hour and a half.
Okay.
That has made that claim.
I mean, they can be partly true. I mean, none of the people who wrote the Gospels knew Jesus, right? I mean, all of them had stories.
Actually, I don't think that's correct.
Not Paul.
Huh?
Not the letters from Paul,
Paul
but in the four
know,
Gospels.
Paul didn't know his life's ministry, didn't know Jesus during the time of his ministry, the best that we can tell. But he certainly knew all the key players who walked and talked with Jesus. Matthew and John, now I'll grant you that this is debated. Matthew and John are supposedly apostles, okay?
But you don't believe that, do you?
I mean, my
understanding is these Gospels were written long before anyone even gave a name to them, that there was no guy named Matthew.
No, these names actually go back. These names actually go back pretty early. We think that these names are tied to these figures in the early part of the second century. That's not something that I'm saying. That's something that an emeritus professor at the University of Tübingen in Germany said in the last 5 years in running down the history of the transmission of these titles to these Gospels.
That they perhaps represent the particular strain of the Gospel that was being delivered, sort of as we would consider a school
and,
of thought.
And, the way the names are worded in Greek and the associations that they have go back very, very early. Now, he happens to believe that the Gospel of John is a composite document that represents what we might call the Johannine school. And normally, if someone says Matthew and John didn't write these Gospels, what they will say is that what we have is a tradition that starts off with Matthew and that runs through those who followed Matthew or those who followed John. So those are those two Gospels. Let me talk about the middle two, because they're really important, I think.
But you would agree just basically that all of these are oral traditions that after several decades were finally written down. They were passed orally from person to person, and that's maybe why the stories changed and why there's different details, and Matthew and Mark and Luke disagree on things, and then they were written down.
Absolutely, but even the study of orality shows us that it is possible to pass on a story and keep the gist of the story faithful in an oral tradition environment. This is part of what is associated with the study of oral traditions. See, what we do, because we're not part of an oral culture, we're so part of a written word culture, we don't even know what it's like to exist in an oral culture. We think that, oh, if it's oral, then it must go and float everywhere. No. I'll use Judaism as an example. You have the 18 benedictions in Judaism, a very well-known, long-established, very long prayer that people memorized because they were part of an oral culture. So the idea that because it's oral, it necessarily floats in these greatly exaggerated ways, I think itself is a greatly exaggerated claim.
Well, the great holy book of the ancient Greeks, for all intents and purposes, which were the Iliad and the Odyssey, were only reduced to writing in 900 BC, and they were 400 or 500 years old by the time they were. So everybody at the time pretty much agreed on the basic gist of the story of the Trojan War. I understand that part.
Yeah, and that's part of what is being said here, is that if you actually look at what we have in the gospel traditions, well, we do get variation of wording. No one's denying that. There's variation of wording on the one hand. But the core of these stories is remarkably stable. Okay? So what you have to believe is not only that there was variation of wording, but that the emerging gist of the story really wasn't anywhere close to who the real Jesus was. That's what I find very hard to accept.
Well, I think back to Thomas Jefferson's rewrite in which he took out all the miracles and mumbo-jumbo. He was attempting to do something very similar, things that could rationally be agreed upon, and you know he's.
But he was doing it for this. Actually, goes back to something we were talking about in the last hour. He was doing this for reasons that I think, you know, the Bible is a difficult book for people who think that God can only act in certain ways. Okay, and so you're immediately forced to have certain explanations for certain events because you've already said in your mind, whether you've labeled it as rational or whatever, that can't happen. So it's got to be a metaphor, or it's got to be theological, it's got to be non-historical, because you've already made the prejudgment in your mind, God doesn't do that. Well, someone comes around, he's a conservative Christian, I'm not necessarily talking about an inerrantist or a fundamentalist, but just a conservative Christian, he says, God can raise people from the dead. I'll accept that, okay? He can bring life out where there is none, okay? The moment you accept that category, okay, the whole way of looking at this material changes.
But Dr. Bach, that's faith, that's not history, right?
Well, I don't think either of us is in a position in one sense to make that statement either way.
Well,
we actually don't.
Look, I can't prove God doesn't exist, but I can't prove God exists either. I mean, neither is capable of proof.
But that doesn't make it unhistorical. That
well,
see, whether
doesn't
I can
it,
prove
though?
It or
I
not,
mean,
whether
it,
I
it,
can
yeah,
prove I, it or not doesn't make it unhistorical.
Well, but there's that word, doctor, believe. you know, but if you're seeking a historical figure, you've got to put believe to the side and see what you can ascertain as fact.
I understand
that with regard to what you've done with the Pauline letters. You've tried to find, and others have too. I believe Dr. Norton did a lovely study on Paul in which he tried to do very much the same thing. But this is the editorial portion of the program, I guess.
Go for it, Bob.
For me, I am much more moved. I am much more inspired. I am much more given to a positive view of humanity when I look at the man Jesus and see what he was willing to say and do in a culture in which he fully understood what would be done to him for it. Because, you know, if you're God and you know you're God, they're going to nail you up, but you're God and you go on being God. But the man Jesus trying to change the entire social structure of a region that had been rent by bloodshed and hatred for, you know, 500 years and more. I mean, if you go back to the time of the Assyrians and the Elamites and the yada, 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 it ain't nothing but blood and gore and death. And to have one man stand up and say, this is not how it works, that's the kind of thing that transcends humanity for me.
Well, see, and you know what's going to be interesting about my response is I sit there and I say, to the extent that's the message of Jesus, that in one sense it doesn't make any difference whether he is man or God. In fact, my case would be it becomes even more powerful when he speaks as God, and yet he doesn't force it on people. What he does is to appeal to the conscience that he has made in people, that's made in the image of God, to think through what it means to be truly human and to be a true creature of God. Now, I actually think that is part of the power and communication of what Jesus gives. But he also says something else that I think is very important, and that is that we need to recognize, all of us, all human beings need to recognize that we are inherently flawed, that we have a need for God, which many people in our culture and our world don't want to acknowledge. You know, they'll say religion is a crutch or however you want to describe it. And that's part of his message as well. I mean, I didn't come to heal those who were healthy. I came to heal the sick and to call them to repentance. Those kinds of ideas, which tells us something about who we are as flawed human beings, all of us. And that message coming from God yet not being forced upon us, there may be consequences for it, but not being forced upon us, but to have us in good conscience embrace what God is offering, is also an important part of that message. And that's why I think it's important that it's not just the teaching of Jesus, the good man, that is where the power is. I actually think it has more power when you realize this is a message from God in the full sense of that term.
So to the extent that you describe a theology in which one is not forced into a belief structure, and you know, that shares a commonality with the great tenet of Islam that says there is no compunction in religion, or no compulsion in religion. How did we get it so wrong? Because the entire history of Christianity has turned into one of compulsion.
Well, and again, I think the reason we get it so wrong is because you have people who so passionately believe and have embraced this worldview that, in some cases, let me say it this way, you have two kinds of conservatives, if I can try and take a shot at it this way. On the one hand, you have the conservative who is what we might call the angry conservative. And what drives oftentimes the angry conservative, this is why you get the thing about, you know, are we being persecuted on the Christmas season, that kind of thing. There's a sense in which they say, you are insulting at least my view of God, and doing so very insensitively. You know, I can't even say Merry Christmas without someone saying, well, that's insulting. And so the reaction comes in a kind of anger. And the anger is not, even though it seems oftentimes to be directed at people, and I'm talking about today, even though it seems directed at people, it's actually more directed by a desire to uphold or defend the honor of God in one sense or another. Now, you have other kinds of conservatives. This is where I tend to identify myself. where they're not angry. They see a lot going on in the world, and they say the world's a mess. They say, just turn on your TV at 10 o'clock and we can see that. And they sit there and there is, for lack of a better description, pain for the world. I mean, there's a real pain at watching people self-destruct. And their desire is to take out this message of Jesus and to say, this is really good for you. I mean, what we are talking about, what we are trying to offer in Jesus, the way we see ourselves, the way we see our humanity, the way we see our flawedness, is really healthy for you. God is in the business of restoring a very broken relationship in a very beautiful kind of way. And so those are the two kinds of, because of gross generalization. Think of it as a spectrum more probably than two categories. But that's kind of the spectrum of what you see from conservatism. And sometimes the anger gets to the point where it outweighs any sense of the compassion that also is motivating a lot of people. And then when you put into it an element to want to control it, to try and get control of it somehow, which is absolutely impossible, but when you try and do that, you see the kinds of movements that you see today.
So do you believe that word that these angry conservative Christians, as you've described them, and Mark has another question, and I know we're running short on time, so we'll try to be as quick as possible. Do these angry Christians, are they ignorant of how they come across? Or are they being willfully in the rest of our faces?
I think, again, that runs across the spectrum. I think in some cases they're being willful about it. In some cases they're fed up and they're not going to take it anymore. And so, you know, so this is the way they deal with that. In other cases, I don't think they're aware of how they come across. I think in other cases they're encouraged to come across this way by other leaders and by the example of other leaders, which I think is unfortunate. And so, that is a very complex, multidimensional question. I think you get a variety of responses that could explain that kind of anger. Some of it's just a raw frustration with the sense that our culture is breaking down in a way that is very unhealthy. And it's kind of spinning out of control. And you know how you sometimes feel when you're on a highway and you're stuck in traffic and you're running late and there's nothing you can do, and you know you're getting later and later all the time, and it just frustrates you even though there's nothing you can do about it? I think sometimes that's what's motivating.
Is there any hope then for an ecumenical dialogue to allay or assuage their fears?
Well, I think we have to be clear about what any kind of ecumenical dialogue is possible of achieving. Is it going to come to some type of great agreement where it says, well, we'll just all tolerate one another and not put religion out on the public square table? They'll never be comfortable with that. Because part of what the religious faith is saying to them is, this is something you're trying to offer your friends and neighbors that actually is of benefit to them. It's because you love them that you share these ideas with them.
But are they missing out on Jesus and feed my sheep?
They're missing out. They're not missing out on Jesus and feed my sheep. They're missing out on Jesus that says love the world with the kind of love that was willing to sacrifice, by which I was even able to sacrifice myself to try and show it. And so it's become a culture of confrontation versus a culture of service and invitation.
But Dr. Bach, I see a real contradiction here, though. I see you saying that there's some Christians that are offended when, someone says happy holidays, sort of an all-inclusive kind of thing. They're offended by a secular culture that they feel impinges on them, though I'm not quite sure how, because they can turn off their TV if they want to. And yet at the same time, they want to be able to share their message with the non-believer. It seems to me that, in fairness, either Christians should be able to share their message with non-believers, and guess what? Non-believers get to share their messages with Christians.
That's
or
my position.
Neither side should share with anybody. But it's unfair for Christians to say, don't tell me I don't believe the divinity of Jesus. That's offensive to me. But at the same time, I want to tell you about the divinity of Jesus, right?
Well, see, actually, I think the position that the last hour and a half, I think, reflects is that we ought to be in a position where we can have a conversation with one another out of our various traditions, interact with one another, and understand, come to a better understanding of what is motivating any and all of us. And
so why do conservative Christians feel like they're stuck in traffic? Are they so incensed about?
Because when you sit there and you say this is Christmas, okay, why do we celebrate this time of the year? For the majority of people, you celebrate it because it is Christmas season. And then you can't say Christmas. Okay, even though
who says you can't say Christmas?
Huh?
I say it's fine for you to say Christmas. Say Christmas, say Hanukkah, say Kwanzaa, say it all.
You know that there's a lot of corporate pressure that exists, well, not corporate pressure, but cultural pressure in certain contexts in which you will only say happy holidays, or you only say, now, remember I said in the very first hour, I think a lot of this is overblown. But I think what it reflects is a symptom of something that people see and they go, why can't I say happy Hanukkah to somebody? You know, why do we have to purge all religious language out of public discourse?
But Dr. Bach, we're not all walking around with little badges that say what our faith is. And there's the running joke of, you know, happy Christmas Kwanzaa Danica.
Right.
There's a bunch of holidays here, and since we're not all walking around with little markers on us, and because there are fair-skinned Muslims and blue-eyed Jews, because of all of that, what you refer to as the corporate response from a strictly merchant's point of view seems to make sense. There's a bunch of holidays. Cover the bases. Say happy holidays. Not because
you hate Christmas.
It's
one thing
but
to say you're saying happy holidays because you're trying to cover all the bases. I think it's another thing to say we shouldn't say Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah or Happy Kwanzaa or whatever the holiday is going to be, whatever, Happy Ramadan, whatever the combination is. And why can't we have a culture that understands we are made up of a variety of religious backgrounds in which any of those expressions should be appreciated for the sentiment that it is attempting to express.
But you're talking about the individual response, not the culture, not the corporate offering. And frankly, there are.
But our corporate culture is mixed. That's part of the point. So why do we? If I can say it this way, and I'm being direct, more direct. So why do we atheize it? Why do we atheize a culture that actually is mixed with religions?
But the fact of the matter is that every believer in any given single religion is an atheist to all others by definition.
But see, if I understand that, okay, and if you understand that, et cetera, then why should I be offended that someone says Happy Hanukkah to someone?
That does not offend me. You're not, and I'm not, but the fact of the matter is, the problems that, and this is, I think this is my essential thesis, Doctor, the problem is not with you and me and Mark Levine, or folks like us, or the audience of this program. The problem is with people who are not intellectually attuned to their faith, who are not interested in doing deep research, who aren't interested in textual criticism or finding extracting some level of historicity out of the text. The problem lies with the people who have the bumper stickers on the back of their car that say, God said it, I believe it, that settles it.
Yeah, but I think the problem here is that when we, if I can say it this way, when we atheize it all, what we do is we commit ourselves to a process in which no one has the opportunity to learn very much at all. Whereas in the context where you can have the kind of dialogue that we're talking about, in the exchange and even the disagreement, but a disagreement in a certain healthy kind of way, then we create a society that learns how to talk to itself. And I actually think in the long run, that takes you far down the road. In fact, my guess is that the premise why you have the program set up the way you do is because you believe in that value very, very deeply.
Oh,
Dr. Bach, I have a compromise suggestion for you. Here's
okay.
my compromise suggestion. With individuals, it is perfectly proper to say Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Hanukkah. If you happen to know the person's religion, Happy Ramadan, Happy New Year, if you know they're an atheist, it's perfectly proper with an individual to give a religious-specific greeting. But when it comes to a greeting that's supposed to be for everybody, whether in my Target store or from my government thing, that either they say Happy Holidays or they say all of the above, Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and Happy Kwanzaa and Happy New Year and have
well,
six
like
signs or 12 signs up.
I like the second solution better than the first, because I think what the second solution recognizes is the actual makeup of our society. And that's kind of my point, is that the only way that the various religions are going to learn how to interact and coexist with one another in the midst of all the theology that they're going to, you know, go back and forth on, is to actually communicate some level of initial kind of respect for one another in the midst of having those conversations. And I think one of the ways to do that is to respect the religious holidays that are very much a part of the of these faiths.
Well, I suppose my final comment, because we have kept you longer than we promised that we would, Doctor. My final comment here is that I have always been mystified by the war on Christmas people in the first place, because so much of this is a matter of discussing the commercialization and overt prostitution of the message of a brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer named Yeshua, whether he was God or not. It's in direct contradiction to everything he taught. You know, the sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and follow me business.
But you've got to remember that for the people who are complaining, the war on the holiday, that actually is also part of it, in the sense of, you know, the other expression that you'll often hear in conservative circles is, remember the reason for the season, okay? The reason for the season isn't that I can walk into Macy's. The reason for the season is to remember and to celebrate who Jesus Christ is for those people. And so, in that sense, that's part of what's producing the frustration. Now I can't even enjoy all the accoutrements that come with the holiday, because people are going to remind me that I can't say the very reason why we have the season, and that just drives some people absolutely batty.
And I will never, I guess I will never, never understand those people. I wish we could. I'd love to continue this conversation, because I'd like to go into the 2,000-year-old history of the martyr issue in Christianity, and I think that ties into this conservative Christian anger as well. There's a, you know, because they want to identify, but I suppose we're at the end. But Dr. Bach, thank you for taking this extra more than an hour. This has been a most enjoyable conversation.
Well, I want to thank you too, Dr. Bach. I very much appreciated our exchange back and forth. I also have a lot of more questions. I didn't even get to what Jesus said on the cross. I had this whole list of things. I hope you'll come back on my show, on Bob's show, and to continue the ecumenical dialogue. I think that, frankly, Americans of all faiths should get to know each other, should be less fearful of difference, and be willing to discuss these things without everyone being so worried about being offended. And so I also very much want to appreciate,
well, I'll
express
say
my
the
thanks
same
here.
Thing. I have the same appreciation, and as I said to you at the end of your show the last hour, I said, I think this is what political correctness ought to be. I think we have a lot of things modeled as political correctness that in the long run short-circuit the ability of our society to really function, because all it does is create enclaves. And that's not healthy to a society.
No, especially not one that considers itself a melting pot and free and has a First Amendment that says everybody gets to believe what they want to, regardless of what everybody else thinks. Dr. Bach, thank you so very much. I wish you a very Merry Christmas.
I wish you a happy holidays, happy Hanukkah, and everything else in between.
And take care, and best of luck with the book. It's nice to see it's doing so well.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Mark?
I'm here. Interesting, huh?
What do you think, my friend?
Well, it's pretty much about as I expected. I was glad that he was, that this was a civil conversation. I do think that we all too rarely approach someone of a different faith and ask these, you know, direct questions. I obviously have some knowledge, as do you, obviously, of early Christianity. I think, and I hope this doesn't sound presumptuous, but I would say that you and I have more knowledge of early Christianity than most Christians. That sounds presumptuous.
I have no doubt of it whatsoever, because part of what happened to me along the way was that I had this knowledge. I went back, I started sharing it with others, and I was told that I was non-doctrinal, I was undogmatic, and quite frankly, blasphemous and heretical.
I thought his conception was interesting.
For having knowledge, Mark. for having knowledge.
I found his concessions interesting. He conceded. At first, he mentioned Josephus, but when I pressed him on it, he said, okay, you're right, most scholars think that, you know, that's a fraud. You know, and, you know, he conceded that Jesus has brothers and sisters. How many Christians know that Jesus had brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I know, and I had a little problem with that, too, saying, you know, they would have been rallying around him. Well, they did rally around him. They were pushing the Jesus cult. They were pushing it so hard that that once again they pissed off the people in the Sanhedrin and they chucked James off a wall. You know, another point in whatever the historicity of the church is, you know, one of the big moments is when Paul has the meeting with Peter and James, and Paul wins. And that's
the other thing. Well,
go ahead. That's largely why we get a Paulinized Christianity as opposed to a Jewish sect / cult. You know, there was a big fight over circumcision.
That's right. Well, and that's very much in the history here, and that's very important. I mean, I think, frankly, if it weren't for circumcision, it might be that Judaism was the massive religion today and Christianity a very small cult, because there were two things the Gentiles didn't want to accept. They liked all the the ideas of morality and love thy neighbor as thyself and all this old Jewish tradition, most of which has come into Christianity.
They liked the idea of an afterlife where slaves would be equal to the rich.
Sure. And that it was easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. The idea that rich isn't always right, that the king isn't always right, that the meek shall inherit the earth, that's very populist stuff. What they didn't like was circumcision and kosher laws. Circumcision is painful, particularly if you're not a baby.
Yeah,
and you know, we want to eat our pork.
And well, not just that. You know, you guys have a history of, you wrote it. Of slaughtering guys
not
while
me
they're
personally.
No, you guys wrote it of slaughtering grown men while they're recovering from their circumcisions.
Well, that's true, but it only happened at one point. It's not what we like to talk about very much.
Well, you know, it,
we have our skeletons too. I don't deny it at all.
Yeah, you know, Jacob's name kind of became mud in the neighborhood, and he had to change it to Israel.
And the argument by one source is that Mary had a carnal relations with another man, and she told her husband it was a virgin birth. But, would seem to be the more likely explanation rather than, you know, God's impregnation. I think there was a Family Guy episode where Mary's like, so then God came to me, and Joseph's like, right, Mary, right.
Yeah, gotcha. It's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
It's quite a story. I wonder if any other, I won't say other because that's offensive. Let's just say I wonder if any adulteress has used that story since Mary. I don't know.
Well, actually it has been. I can't think of the name right off that, but she wasn't an adulterer yet. She was just a fornicator.
Oh, I see. Okay, same idea.
Wouldn't William Donahue love us now?
I didn't
get a chance to get to Dr. Bach with that one either, because that's one of the more delightful moments in the current political season is the fact that William Donahue of the Catholic League is absolutely burnt scorched about Reverend Huxterby and his little Christmas commercial.
Really? Because I'm burnt scorched too, but for entirely different reasons. What's Donahue's problem?
He's trying to give the secret lodge high sign to the evangelicals in Iowa that he's going to be on their side, and us poor little Catholics are going to be left out in the cold.
Oh my God! Well, I agree.
I mean,
with
to the point
Donahue,
that he's talking.
One of us has to change our views, Bob. I don't know.
to the point that William Donahue is complaining about a white cross floating across in the background.
No way.
Way. He says that the white bookshelf that's behind Huckabee in the commercial actually floats.
I did hear that. That's hilarious. Like I said, if Bill Donahue and I have the same criticisms of the same commercial, I don't know. Maybe I have to change my views on it.
Well, how did you feel about the naked chocolate Jesus at Easter? I mean, you know, you guys may have more in common than you know. Because
don't go there.
I know. Oh, listen, I got a couple of blinkies here. Let's see if there's anybody there. Okay, you're a busy signal. All righty, that's a person.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan, how are you, dear?
Where should be.
Ramen.
What did you think of our theological discussion, Susan?
Well, the very first part of that, most of it I found fascinating. I have to admit, though, the last part of it, I found rather whiny.
We were whining?
No, he was.
You mean about the War on Christmas stuff?
Yeah. This guy is a member of the most populous religion on the planet, and he was coming across like he was being persecuted. Give me a break.
Well, that's
you
but that's but that's part
religion.
That's part of the fundamentalist culture, and that's what I was mentioning at the end that we didn't have a chance to get into. Elaine Pagels, and I can't remember the other woman's name. I've mentioned the book before, but it's called Reading Judas, about the discovered Judas text. And what they've identified out of that is that there actually appears to have been a significant discussion and disagreement, excuse me, in the so-called early church about whether or not it was good for followers of Christ to gleefully court martyrdom and torment and torture and death. The crowd that won out was the crowd that said, yep, the more you die in misery, the better off Jesus likes it. Sort of like when John Ashcroft told people, you know, out in the Northwest that he didn't want them to be able to die at their own hand if they were terminally ill. You know, because Jesus
yeah,
wants people
PR.
In misery.
It's great PR.
What struck me in this whole conversation was where he kept saying, well, there was a group of Jews that believed this stuff. Yeah, there was. There were also 1,000 other groups of Jews that believed 1,000 other different things. And this one,
oh, yeah.
You know, became a huge religion. But what about the other 999? Why are they false and yours true?
And that's why, that's why I
didn't
really
get an answer to this.
Go ahead, Susan.
Lousy with cults. By the way, there is an AP story out. And this has to do with our his discussion on the, quote, war on Christmas. 4 Jewish students assaulted on a New York subway received by fundamentalist Christians received help from a fellow Muslim writer.
Yeah, I think I saw that. That was pretty... pretty sickening on one hand, and yet inspiring of a little bit of hope
on
the
other. Right.
Yeah.
I sent that around to all my family, by the way, Susan. Just so you know. I was honored by the Muslim who worked hard to save the Jews that were getting beat up. I guess I looked more at the bright side of the coin rather than the dark side.
Well, so did I. I just find it ironic that.
But if
what I found was appalling. What set this whole incident off was 2 girls.
Cherchez la femme?
I don't remember the 2 women. What girls did what?
2 girls who were with this group
with the Christian group.
Men, yeah, a Christian man.
The 8 men.
The Jewish people say, in answer to being greeted with Merry Christmas, they, of course, said Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah, right. That's how it happened, as I recall, right. There are eight Christians and 2 women and 2 Jews, and they say to the Jews, Merry Christmas, and they respond Happy Hanukkah, and they get beat up.
And the girls started off with the epithet, and that set off the whole mess.
Well, you've got to understand that this idea of martyrdom, this idea of persecution, is central to so many of these fundamentalist faiths, because if they're just out there being left to worship as they please, then it doesn't explain why nobody wants anything to do with them, because you know they're right.
Yeah.
So
it's very weird for me for the majority and the powerful to complain about persecution. I mean, I'm sure it happens somewhere.
No, you've got
you know,
no, Mark. But, you've got a the Jewish people have and the Muslims in this case, in many instances, have legitimate claims to understanding persecution.
I mean, look, if you're talking about Christians in Muslim lands, they are being persecuted, and Muslims and Christian lands are being persecuted, and basically Jews are getting persecuted everywhere, except in Israel.
And everybody hates the atheists.
And everyone
not
hates the atheists.
The witches.
Except in communism, then the atheism persecutes the religious. So, what's that song? The black folks hate the white folks, and the Hindus hate the Muslims. Everyone hates the Jews. I forget who sang that, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to tell you, if Huckabee gets elected, I'm leaving the country.
Well, but you've got, again, I remind you, you've got a fairly short trip. The rest of us aren't so lucky, Susan.
Well,
we just have to put away our little flying spaghetti monster icons and worship in secret.
Bob, did you think he was filibustering with me a bit? I mean, when I asked him about the virgin birth,
Susan, I've got another blinky here, so we'll run along. But
okay.
Thanks, we
thank
do
you.
Appreciate
nice
it,
night.
Dear. Bye now.
Ramen.
We're all converting to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, by the way, Mark.
Fair enough. You can't prove it doesn't exist.
No, you can't.
No, you can't.
You know, I've been touched by his noodly appendage.
don't go there.
I'm sitting here with a beautifully lettered copy of an excerpt from the sixth letter of St. Alfredo Marinara to the church at Chef Boyardee.
I do love pasta, and so I'm ready to join your church.
Well, get your pirate costume. But you asked a question, and by way of answering it, I was in the chat room, and I said to one chatter, and I don't know a better way of putting it, I felt a little bit like a member of Gamblers Anonymous who'd been dragged back into a casino and was just sitting there shaking, ready to throw money into the one-armed bandit.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt him too much, but, you know, I mean, I asked him about the virgin birth. He concedes, which is very interesting to me, all the Roman and Greek antecedents of the virgin birth, which are there, no question. And he admits, which I thought was great, that Isaiah, you know, wasn't anything about it. So he basically was conceding, I never got to put the final QED on it, but conceding that the virgin birth, it's just not a Jewish concept. You know, Messiah, Jewish concept. Son of God, virgin birth, not Jewish
concept.
Not
so Jewish. Kind of a little bit Egyptian, a whole lot of Greek.
Exactly.
But, there was some filibustering going on, but also what was driving me nuts, and it sort of leaked out, but not in a full, you know, there you have it. When we're talking about finding anything historical, there's no there, Mark, because I asked him about a historical Jesus, and he started telling me about a historical Paul. You know, Paul wrote Paul's letters, okay? I mean, that's
right.
Pretty well
no, I agree.
Agreed upon.
I agree.
And so you can find some sort of markers toward Paul's personality. I found it fascinating that he freely confessed that there are only four that we know that are actually, you know, are Paul's.
Right.
Flip-floppians and Galatians, Galatians or whatever. Not Paul. But anyway, so... I mean, I don't know where, you know, he seems to take a sort of scholarly issue with people like Bart Ehrman. But, you know, one of the things that Bart Ehrman said on my program a year or so ago now was that everybody who goes to any sort of self-respecting seminary learns all this stuff. They learn the Hebrew. They learn the Koine Greek. They read it.
Right.
They do the history. They learn textual criticism. They learn where the holes are. And what Dr. Ehrman said is that what happens, though, is there are those who go out and teach it and tell it and explain it and try to make it comprehensible. And then there are those who go back into the First Baptist Herpetological Seminary or the sanctuary or whatever and don't, you know, they follow the W.C. Fields rule. Never smarten up a chump. Your tradition is one of tremendous scholarship, and I have such respect for that. On the other hand, for the life of me, one of the things that always gives me such a cackle is that, you know, Baptists and so forth are very, very proud of the fact, we're not Catholic! But every last bit of their fundamentalist dogma is.
Yeah.
And part of that dogma is one in which, you know, I quoted the bumper sticker. You know, God said it, that settles it. I believe it, that settles it.
What's striking is exactly what you say, though. I mean, when it comes down to the historical scholarship, there isn't that much difference of opinion. I was struck by how much we agreed, Dr. Bach and I, about this historical fact and that historical fact. And, yes, the Gospels were written
by people
who knew Jesus and things like that.
If there's a failure point, though, Mark, the failure point is that, and it wasn't really possible to get out of him, is that even though you agree on all those historical points, you're going to come to a point where you go, but he wasn't a magic zombie god. And he's going to go, Yes, he was. And you're going to say,
and
prove it to
fake.
Me historically, and he's going to say, because he's God.
Yeah. And that was my point all along, that I'm not saying I can prove Jesus wasn't God. I can't prove the spaghetti monster isn't God.
Because he is.
But my point is it certainly is not a historical fact. It is theological teaching, and that's fine, and I respect that. That's why I began with that whole 10-minute apologetic, you know, thing at the outset, because I don't want anyone to claim that I'm being anti-Christian or, you know,
yeah, and that's
what you
why,
want to believe,
that's why
don't
I, you know, when you take an obviously high-quality mind, And you know, I loved my theology classes, but got A pluses and stuff. It was just cool. Because I guess I had a mind for it. But you look up and you realize I'm sitting here doing supposedly scholarly work on how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and I can't prove there's an angel.
Right.
And at that point, you realize that you're engaging in a sort of intellectual masturbation.
Which I've always loved.
Because masturbation's fun.
And so is intellectual stuff.
Well, that's what I mean. Whether it's intellectual or physical, you know, as long as there's no sandpaper involved, it's fun.
Yeah, so I've always enjoyed that kind of thing.
But sometimes you got to get up
and
go to work.
My people's full of a lot of that, I have to tell you. I mean, if you've ever seen Talmudic scholars argue, I assure you, intellectual masturbation, we have elevated to fine art.
Well,
my people have.
Yeah, and it's... dude, you guys went pro 2,500, 3,000 years ago.
We certainly did. That's why I said two Jews have three opinions, and three Jews have about 12, so it gets really complicated after
four
that.
Jews is a riot, you know.
Pretty much.
We've got a couple more blinkies, Mark. You got a couple more minutes?
Yes, let's do them.
Okay. Hi, who have we got?
Hi, Bob. It's Betsy.
Hey, Betsy. How are you, dear?
Hi, Betsy.
I'm good. Hi. Listen, I've listened to every single minute of this, and I'm fascinated. First of all, Mark, I am really impressed by how much you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, me, I'm just a moron sitting here licking the window. I know.
I'm impressed by how much you know, Bob.
Bob, I already knew that you know this stuff. It was new to me that Mark knows this stuff. And, you know, you've said that you've studied it.
I'm just playing, Betsy, you know that.
Okay. The reason that I called, what I didn't like about what he was saying, and I didn't like about his whole tone, and this is a problem that I have with a lot of Christianity, actually, at least modern Christianity in the United States as I see it, is this whole, I have something good, so it's my job to share it with my neighbors.
Yeah, you which know? Is really taking some, Jesus and turning him on his ear, Betsy.
Some of your neighbors are really quite happy with their own faith and would really love for you to go back in your house and, you know, leave us alone.
Yeah, well, I noticed Jersey in the chat room mentioning the fact that he had his Jehovah's Witness visit today. We had ours a couple of days ago. They come here and, you know, to share their vision. We've got a running gag around the house because Agnes goes and hides in the bathroom and says that she's and we describe that as putting her in the witness protection program.
The Jehovah's Witness protection program.
Precisely.
That's funny.
It turns Jesus on his ear. Because he wasn't going out, you know, if you take at face value what is contained in the Gospels, he was...
I've never read or know anything about other than what I hear on your show.
Wouldn't hurt you to learn.
It wouldn't hurt you to read them. It doesn't affect your Jewish faith, Betsy. It really doesn't.
You know, thanks to a good day school education, I did not know any Christmas carols until high school, so, you know.
See, Betsy, my Jewish education, it has to do with my special rabbi, who you heard a couple months ago. My Jewish education included Christianity and Islam. We had a course in Christianity and a course in Islam at my synagogue. That's the glories of Rabbi Fellner. Admittedly, not every Jewish education includes that. But it's one of the things that where I learned all this early Christianity.
I teach at a synagogue that does. 8th and 9th grade.
And I think every synagogue should teach Christianity and Islam. How can you not teach Judaism's daughter religions who have a billion adherents around the globe? I think every Jew should have a basic understanding of Christianity and Islam. Absolutely.
And
then, you know, while you're there, go for Hinduism and Buddhism, but
bingo.
At least those two.
Yeah, get with the Shintos, the Taoists, and the Confucians while you're at it.
It's interesting, the class that I had, I teach bar and bat mitzvah kids, and the class that is now in, I had as fourth and fifth graders, and now they're, I guess, in eighth and ninth grade. When I first had them, one of our first conversations about prayer and about living in a multicultural world, and a lot of them have parents who are of different faiths from each other, and one of the first things that came up was, what do you do when you're at a sleepover or summer camp or whatever and other kids are praying and the prayer is in Jesus' name? And then, like, what do you do and how do you react and what's okay and what's not okay and, you know, does everybody feel awkward? And it was very...
What did you tell them, Betsy? How did you tell them to respond?
I told them that it's very awkward. I told them that it's awkward for me.
It's awkward for me, too, but what I do, I'm just curious if you do the same thing I do. So what do you do when that happens?
I told them that we had next-door neighbors. We had Mormon next-door neighbors for a while. And the Mormon next-door neighbors, we would occasionally get together for a meal. And I got to learn sort of how they led a prayer at the beginning of the meal. And I would say Amen right before he got to the part that I didn't want to say Amen to.
There you go.
That's
one way to deal with it.
Very quietly.
I remember being in a private school in Nashville, Tennessee, that was supposed to be a non-Christian school, and they would pray in Jesus' name. And, you know, I remember not bowing my head as well as not saying Amen as sort of my tiny way of But as an adult, I respond differently. As an adult, if you know, if I'm in a group, I just don't say Amen. But if I'm in a small gathering and someone says their prayer in their way, then I will usually come back with a prayer in my way. That's a more inclusive prayer.
This same family that we got together with, I did that as well. And we would say whatever food we were eating, we would say the blessing in Hebrew.
See, it's mm-hmm. This is fascinating to me because where I come from, the fundamentalists are so sectarianized, Betsy and Mark, that if a member of the Church of Christ marries a Methodist, it's considered a mixed marriage.
Really?
I'm not kidding. People actually and Betsy, you might find it interesting to note this. People actually have those kinds of discussions inside fundamentalist Christianity about being in each other's churches and each other's homes. I'm not
really
kidding. I've known Baptists who were extremely uncomfortable inside a Church of Christ because the Church of Christ is just fundamentalism on acid. Okay, and the questions have been posed. You know, well, what do I do when the Church of Christ are praying? What do I do? And, you know, the response that was always given, pray. Yes. You pray, too.
Right. Well, what,
sure.
That's what I told my students. I said, if you're at a sleepover and the kids are praying before they go to sleep, you know, don't get on the floor. Don't, say the evening Shema.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say Shema's a bedtime prayer. Say the evening Shema. Learn the whole bedtime prayer. You know, it's a little longer than that. Learn the whole bedtime prayer. Or bring it with you on a card or whatever, if you know, and you pray too. But, you know, but pray sitting up and pray, you know, in a Jewish style.
You know, one of the fascinating things, and you, Betsy, you probably don't know about this to the extent that Mark does, just by virtue of exposure. One of the single most prayed Christian prayers is what's called the Lord's Prayer, the Pater Noster in Latin.
I do know it.
And Mark, you can disagree with me if you will, but it has always struck me as being one of the proofs of the very fundamental Jewishness of Jesus. Because textually, you know, it ends, for most Protestants, it ends, for thine is the power and the glory and the king, yada, yada, yada. That's not in there. That was added on.
Yeah, bring us today our daily bread.
Forgive us our sins.
That's not a Jewish concept. the Jewish concept is not that to ask God for our daily bread. The Jewish concept is we thank God afterwards.
It's well, the Jewish concept, concept is we bless, we bless
oh,
God.
Two Jews, three opinions.
No, but I mean, because our whole idea is, you know, I mean, we don't, you know, we're Jews. We don't know that, we don't say thank you until we already have it in our hands.
True, but we do thank God who brings forth bread from the earth.
Thank God. Absolutely.
Okay, all right.
But the, you know, the,
see, Bob, you saw it in practice.
I do that. Yeah. I move in mysterious ways, guys.
Two Jews, two out of three opinions.
It's fascinating because, you know, the one thing we do get is a little portrait of a culture that was, and we don't often see this, a little portrait of a culture on the verge of collapse. Because within 35 years of the, roughly, assuming, and all of this assumes that it's all real, okay? Yeah. I mean factually real, not faithfully real.
Yeah.
Within 35 years of the crucifixion of Jesus, the entire culture was in tatters.
That's right.
And so we get this brilliant little portrait.
Talk about last throes, by the way.
Yeah, you get this brilliant little portrait of what a culture looks like when it's on the verge of collapse and doesn't necessarily realize it.
Yeah, and doesn't really know where to go or where to come from. You know, what's interesting is that the Romans were actually, for emperors, fairly liberal with regard to religions, and most religions just sort of said, okay, you know, you want to rule us, fine, we'll give our taxes to Caesar, leave us alone. It was the Jews that said, no, we are independent, we have our own state, we have our own kings.
We are the chosen, we've got...
And, you know, this tiny little people took on 12 Roman legions. It was not a good idea.
Yeah, well, there's a question as to whether that was intelligent.
As your guest was saying, the Jews had just recently survived the Maccabean period.
Well, that's true. They beat the Greeks, so they thought they could beat the Romans, too. I mean, that's true. It happened right after Hanukkah.
Not only was it that they beat the Greeks and they thought they... I mean, I agree with that, but I also think that the other piece of it is that they saw the dangers of assimilation. I mean, that's a lot of what the Hanukkah story is about, you know, assimilation.
And that's a lot of what the Jesus story is about. I mean, talk about assimilation. Here you had this ancient culture, really very sophisticated for its time, Jewish culture, come up against its real first sophisticated philosophy, and that's the Greek philosophy. I mean, sorry, ancient Egyptians, it was not that sophisticated a philosophy. You know, the pharaoh is the divine representative of God.
No,
blah,
when
blah,
you're
blah.
Making but, gods out of hippopotamuses, you're not just that sophisticated.
Yeah, but the Greeks were extremely sophisticated, and one of the things I've always taught when I teach Jewish history is what's fascinating about the Hanukkah Wars. It's the first wars I'm aware of in all of human history that weren't fought over land or territory or possessions or slaves. They were fought over ideas. Now, unfortunately, they would presage a whole couple millennia of religious wars. But the idea that a lot of Jews accepted Greek ideas completely and rejected their Jewish heritage. And many rejected the Greek ideas. And in many ways, the Hanukkah Wars were a civil war and not near as pretty as our lit menorahs in this Hanukkah season. But the history is fascinating.
Yeah, it was a handful of Jews with weapons.
Right.
Against a handful of other Jews who were Greek Jews.
Yeah, disagreeing with each other.
That's right. It's true.
Weapons and opinions. It was a mess.
Right, opinions and swords.
And swords, right. It's better to have the opinions without the swords. It's a little bit better.
But Betsy, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did, very much so. And
you know, a lot of people told me not to do today's show.
My son has agreed to listen to it. He desperately needed to go and visit with his friends and play on the PS3 this afternoon, but he agreed to listen to it on podcast.
Well, you know.
Well, yeah, it's all going to be on podcast. I got to tell you, before you go, there are a lot of Jews and Christians told me not to do today's show.
You're kidding.
They said it doesn't relate
Why?
To politics.
What
one,
this?
I think they
so
were afraid I would offend people.
Politics.
I thought they were afraid I would offend people. That's why, one of the reasons I gave that sort of very long discussion, you know, at the beginning. And a lot of people said, you know, kind of like Jews and Christians are getting along, you know, why are you raising these old issues that caused so many people to die in the past? And, no, I did. A lot of people said, like, you know.
They don't cause people to die in the future.
I agree. Obviously, I did the show. But I just want to let you
Mark,
know there are people who thought I shouldn't.
I love the concept of you getting mail saying, please don't sink to Bob's level.
You're kidding.
I'm no comment.
You're
no
kidding.
Comment. No comment.
Well, Betsy, again, thank you very, very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And take great care. Time. And, you know, I hope your son enjoys the recording.
I'll let you know.
All right, thanks.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
I know a lot of people that are going to check out this podcast, Bob. Actually, I got a lot of support from people, too. It's interesting. My listeners were very supportive, and, oh, my God, I got to check this out. It was really the people I know, my friends, and well, friends more than family, that were like, are you sure you want to do this, Mark? And I'm like, yeah, I can discuss anything. But it all goes back to that old thing that my mom told me when I was about 6 years old, which was, Mark, don't challenge anybody's religion unless they challenge yours. And, you know, I respect my mom for saying that. It was good advice to a six-year-old. It avoided me from being beat up and things like that. I didn't even get to the question of the trick that I was told when I was three when people try to convert me, which is when they ask you, why don't you accept Jesus as the Messiah, you simply say, well, my Bible says that when the Messiah comes, we're going to have peace on earth. We don't have peace on earth, no Messiah. The simplest proof in the world. I didn't even get a chance to go there with Dr. Bach, but maybe one day we'll have him back and I can do that.
I hope so. Want to do a couple more? I'm not enamored of running the news or anything. Want to go to a couple more blinkies?
Sure, fine by me.
Okay, let's see here. Yeah, this one. Oh, you're a busy signal.
Have faith, people. Stick it through.
You know, I don't know why, but people think that if they hang up and they dial a different number, that somehow or another it's I don't know. Well, I'm running out of blankies.
Really? They're all busy signals?
Maybe not. Yep, they all gave up.
I'm
sure somebody will ring back in. People, you know, they'll wait for 3 hours on hold with other hosts. You and me and people on the Hornet. Nope, if we don't get on, we're hanging up. And, you know, to a certain extent, maybe I think that may be an act of kindness, too, for those who are calling in on the toll-free line and don't want to, you know, run the bill up, which I think is
really
sweet.
That may be true. That may be true. And all part of the holiday spirit. I guess we're coming up in, well, actually, we've passed the end of the hour.
Yeah,
but,
we have. I was going to say, these little exercises always turn out to be among the most, the best love programs we have, because I think that I think people like to hear us interacting as opposed to either one of us filibobstering or filimarkstering.
I hear you.
So, you know, I appreciate you carrying over. And
it's very interesting where we come with our respective religious traditions, and of course most of the time you and I just end up agreeing, but we come from different directions to get to the same point.
That's true. And you know, I remind you, Mark, that the horn section is always there for you anytime you want to jump in. You know how far off the deep end we went last night? John wasn't able to go with All Foxed Up, so Peter and I were left to our own devices. And as a consequence, we got so into the conversation that we wound up doing 2 hours without even realizing it.
No way.
Yeah.
That's great.
Wait, we do have another caller.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and bring that person on. Hi, who we got?
This is Alan.
Hey, Alan, how are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I was wanting to ask the guy, your guest, a question. I was going to ask him if Jesus. I've been told all my life that Jesus was sent here as a God to die for sin. Yet Jews do not believe in original sin. I was going to ask them, where did this idea of original sin come from? How would you think he would answer that question?
You want to take a run at that, Mark? I mean,
well, sure.
Your book.
Okay. Jews definitely have a very different concept of original sin from Christians. I mean, Jews believe that people are born, babies are born innocent without knowledge of good or evil. Not born good either. But they're not born evil, certainly, and that they, you know, make those choices throughout their life. However, Jews do believe, based on the story of the Adam and Eve, that prior to eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and Jews understand it to be allegorical. There are extremely few Jews that reject evolution. But the idea is that we were all creatures. We were like animals. We, you know, tried to eat and copulate and sleep, and we didn't have moral choices to make. And that actually, I think, is very fitting with evolution. I don't think amoebas make moral choices. I don't think there are many moral choices that, you know, ants or even dogs make, maybe some for dogs. But as we get more evolved, we have a more chance to make a moral choice. So the idea is that the possibility of sin does begin in Jewish concept with the story of Adam and Eve. Before you know what's good and evil, you can't sin. You know, a dog can't sin. You know, despite the fact that he may go on the floor. but the idea is that, so there is this concept of, from the first man, the first real man, that people certainly can sin. And of course, in the Jewish concept, you have to pray to God to atone for sins against God. Interestingly, in the Jewish concept, you can't pray to God to atone for sins against man. If you do a person wrong, you have to fix it. You have to pay damages. There's a whole judicial system. You have to apologize to that person and get forgiveness from that person. But for sins against God, you can atone by praying directly to God. There is no intermediary, although in the ancient Jewish times, you were supposed to sacrifice something, and that's where you get the idea of you bring in your sheep and your goats and you sacrifice them. The idea is, in order to atone for a sin, you have to give something up, and it was always animal sacrifice. The story of Abraham and Isaac makes clear that human sacrifices are not allowed in Judaism, only animal sacrifices.
Is that all? Is that all pretty much done for now? I mean, the whole sacrifice business within Judaism?
I mean, at the time of the temple, there were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. There were also the Essenes, but we won't go there right now. But the Sadducees were basically the priests, and they were the temple cult, and they were the people in power who did all the sacrifices at the great temple. And the Pharisees were the ones that said, you know, yeah, the sacrifices are all part of Jewish tradition. We can't deny that. But they're not the focus of it. The focus of it is do good to your fellow man, and that's people like Hillel and frankly, many of Jesus' teachings as well. When the temple was destroyed, that kind of ended it for the Sadducees. I mean, how do you build a religion based on temple sacrifice when you don't have a temple anymore? And so the priests kind of slunk away. There was really nothing for them to do, and Pharisaic Judaism became really the only Judaism left from that period. There still is, I mean, it's still there. We still read about the temple in our Bible. You know, there are some Jews that are, we would call fundamentalist Jews, that talk about rebuilding the third temple in Jerusalem.
Yeah, but
they tend to get Israel in a lot of trouble.
And I don't want to open up this can of worms or anything, Mark. But what's one of the fundamentalists, and you probably get the same press release as I do. What's this about the Muslim group broadcasting from the Temple Mount and getting everybody all in a tizzy? Did you see that?
I didn't see that, no. Are okay. They broadcasting from the temple?
Yeah, it was like a radio broadcast or something, and they've got, you know, the Daily Hummus or whatever that broadcasts from the Temple Mount.
That doesn't offend me, but listen, anything you do on the Temple Mount is bound to offend someone. I mean, they were working underground to look at ancient, the foundations of the Herodian walls.
Yeah, scientific inquiry.
You may recall, they opened the door on the other side of the tunnel, and that was Arafat's excuse to begin a whole, you know, violent action. So, you know, anything you do on the Temple Mount is bound to offend somebody. But, no, I didn't read that.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. Did I answer your question about original sin? I hope I did.
Oh yeah, I thought that sounded pretty good. I was just wondering, is there any Jews that believe that there's a Messiah that is to come in the future?
Oh sure, absolutely. Oh, no question. I mean, that is an ancient Jewish concept. As I said, it began with the idea that we were going to get King David back, or I mean, a descendant of him, and go back and there are Jews that, particularly with the state of Israel existing again, that absolutely. I tend to like the Kabbalistic notion, which was really not developed till the Middle Ages, but the idea that, as Rabbi Fellner has taught me, that the Messiah will come when we no longer need him. In other words, the Messiah is supposed to rule over a perfect world, and if we perfect the world, then the Messiah will come, but it's our duty to do the task. That's what Tikkun Olam is all about. So, but yes, traditionally, absolutely, there's a prayer in Hebrew, Ani Ma'amin, I believe in the coming of the Messiah. In Passover, we sing a song to Eliyahu, Hanavi, Elijah. By the way, Elijah's supposed to bring the Messiah. That's been the tradition, by the way, for thousands of years, and I don't read Elijah anywhere in the New Testament. Where the heck is Elijah? He's supposed to bring me my Messiah.
Angels on the head of a pin again.
Here we go.
Wasn't he part of the Transfiguration?
The Transfiguration. I don't know what the Transfiguration is. I admit it. What's the Transfiguration?
That's pre-crucifixion, and the apostles look up, and lo and behold, there's Jesus carrying on a conversation with a physical embodiment of Elijah and a couple of others.
Okay, all right. You know the New Testament better than I do. I'll grant you. So they have a vision of Elijah. Okay, so all right. There's the Elijah answer. There you go. All right.
Yeah, because you see, this was work.
You got to plug the story with whatever you need. That's true.
That's the whole point. This was worked backwards.
It was worked backwards, exactly. What you need. That's where whole Bethlehem comes from. By the way, there's absolutely no reason to believe historically that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Mark has nothing about it. It's the oldest work.
And that's what I was just getting to. Mark is a very austere sort. It's the closest to a Joe Friday gospel that you can get, just the facts.
Right, and there's nothing in there about, and it, arguably there's nothing in there about a resurrection either. A lot of people think that last part was added.
And you get the Judas story in Mark, and it's really just not much to it. And by the time you get to the last gospel, he's possessed by a demon and being cast out by Jesus.
Wasn't that the gospel according to Mel Gibson? Wasn't that the last?
Well, true. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Can I slip in one more question?
Sure, Alan.
Go ahead.
This Messiah that the Jews are looking forward to come in the future, Messiah supposed to pay a price for sin?
No. There's nothing anywhere in the Hebrew Bible about the Messiah paying a price for sin. No. What the Messiah is a king, and he's to rule over the Jewish people, and frankly, the concept grew in the telling. It was just this, king was going to go back and rule over Israel, but it grew into the telling. Certainly Dr. Bach is right, into the ideas he would sit at the right hand of God and rule over everybody, not just the Jews. You tell a good story, it grows over the hundreds of years, and he would rule over a time of perfect peace, and Isaiah tells us the lion will lie down with the lamb, and there will be war no more. So I'm really looking forward to that time, because I'm going to save a lot of money in taxes.
Isn't this
Without war anymore? Yeah. Plus, I want to see lions hanging out with lambs. I think that'd be kind of fun to watch on Discovery Channel.
You're a mess.
Could it be in the Kabbalah that supposed to be symbolism?
Well, what symbolism is largely for the individual to determine, isn't it, Mark?
Oh, it is. I mean, look, it's a great concept. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. It's another thing we sing about. Lo yisagoya goy charev. It's one of our songs. We read from Isaiah. When the Messiah comes, they shall beat their swords into plowshares. Man shall learn war no more. The lion shall lay down with the lamb. This is the thing that I understood when I was 3 years old. When the Messiah comes, there will be peace on earth and goodwill toward man. And it's something we should all work toward every single day. And the Messiah will come. And that's why we Jews don't believe the Messiah has come yet, because there ain't a lot of peace on earth and not enough goodwill toward men, and lions still aren't hanging out with lambs. But one day we will beat our swords into plowshares. And what I see, Alan, and I, that's the reason why I'm kind of mocking it, but I also respect it, because I'm not saying I believe that this literally is going to happen, me personally. There are Jews that do. But for me, it's a wonderful concept. It's a wonderful goal. And so it's a wonderful thing to teach. Whether it literally happens or not, let us all work toward the day when we can beat our swords and guns and nuclear weapons into plowshares to make crops, and man shall learn war no more. It's a wonderful concept. I don't care, really. It's not going to happen in my lifetime, but it's something I can work toward. And I respect that in my religion. Whether it's literally going to happen or not, I'll leave to the future people to figure out.
Alan, thanks a lot.
Christians should do the same.
Exactly.
Well, have a good day.
Well, they're waiting for the second coming, Bob. I mean, not yep. Bob. Alan. Alan, Jesus is going to do all this the second time around. He's going to finish the job. That's the Christian concept.
Oh, brother. Alan, take
care.
He
didn't finish it.
More like the Kabbalah. There's a few Christians who believe it symbolically, I would hope.
More than a few. Alan, good to talk to you. Take care, all right?
Thank you. Bye.
We've got another call, and we will go to it rather quickly. But I want to ask you a question, because you take a fairly rationalist approach to your faith. I'm fairly well versed in the ancient history of that region. Is the concept of the Messiah part and parcel of, you know, because you mentioned, you know, at first it starts out, you know, we're getting David back. Incidentally, you know, the Arthur myth for the British comes out of that too, because
sure.
He's coming back too.
Right, because he was a great king. We want him back.
Yeah. So, you know, the Messiah mythos does not come out of, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, that kind of stuff.
No,
it's not the
you don't see anywhere before King David. There's no discussion of it whatsoever anywhere.
So the Messiah concept only happens, and I'm not being disrespectful, but historically speaking, the Jewish people have been a lot like a lot like the Miami Dolphins this year. Everybody kicked their butts. The Babylonians kicked their butts. The Syrians kicked their butts. The Assyrians. And you get that idea of a time when war will visit you no more, when you are the one who has had war visited upon you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely. We can all dream.
Yeah, it's always the victims who yearn for an end to war.
Of course. Not the right. The people in charge with the nuclear warheads—they don't want an end to war.
Right.
Just the people that are being victimized.
So
absolutely.
You know. So it is reasonable to think that line of thinking came out of the culture in which it was born.
I think so. I do.
Because David represented a time in Jewish history when, what's the musical Camelot say? When once there was a spot for happy ever aftering, you know, that there was a brief little time when the people of Israel were not beset.
No, heck, we had about 100 years, and that's about all it lasted with David and Solomon. We had this huge kingdom, which today would include Israel and the Sinai, and today what is Syria and Jordan and Lebanon. Talk about greater Israel. David kicked ass. Now, he did so because the Greeks were weak. It's before the Greeks. This is, the Egyptians were out of power. You know, we always seem to have power only when the
There was the transition in the Mesopotamian region, and nobody had consolidated powers. The Hittites.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Assyrians. So, but it was a great time, and you always want to go back to the glory. I mean, the Greeks did the same thing, you know, the glory of their ancient past. Americans say, you know, back in the good old days, blah, 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 blah. Every culture remembers their peak and wants everything to be just like those days. It makes perfect sense. The irony is that theologically, there's real problems with David. I mean, he was a rascal. He did a lot of things that, frankly, if he'd been if things had not gone well for Israel, if Assyria had invaded the time of David, I just know those people who were, as you say, back forming the literature would say, well, it's because he sinned. He sinned against Uzziah, Beersheba's husband, and sent him to the front and all of that. Of course, God punished him and punished the Jewish people, and they all were destroyed. But because they weren't, because it was good times, and David was kind of a nasty moral king, they had to attribute all these wonderful things to David, when really, frankly, there were a lot of kings that were a lot more humane, let's say, than King David.
Have you ever read a wonderful book? You ever read any Joseph Heller?
Yes, I have.
You ever read a wonderful
book? I read Catch 22 is all I've read, actually.
Well, next time you're going somewhere and you need some reading material, pick up a copy of God Knows.
Okay.
By Joseph Heller. It's a fictional autobiography of David. And being Joseph Heller, it's extremely funny, but it's also extremely thought-provoking. And it begins with the concept, it's not that God's not talking to me anymore, I'm not talking to him.
David, I mean, you read what he did to kind of trick Saul into getting the power. I mean, he was not exactly... David, I'll tell you, and this may be I may be offending everybody with this, but David kind of reminds me of Bill Clinton. In the essence of, he knew how to get power, he knew how to play dirty when he needed to, that, you know, basically his intentions were good, but he was no Boy Scout.
And the argument has been made on more than one occasion that he and Jonathan were lovers.
Yes, that's true too. Although I think, as I read those stories, that actually David was leading on Jonathan. as I read those stories, Jonathan is gay. I'm not sure about David.
Jonathan had a little man crush.
Had a man crush, exactly. And David leads him on to get to his father, the king, to take over. David uses Jonathan. That's how I read those stories. not a very pretty picture.
Yeah, that's just ugly. All right, let's try another phone line, Mark, if you're okay with that.
Go for it.
Oh, there's another give-upper. Oh, nope, they quit too. So, you know, what a wonderful evening. You know, we wiped out an hour and a half of my show too. You know, these topics.
You certainly have.
These topics, they're grabbers.
They are. Well, you know, people don't talk openly and honestly about religion very much, and it's just like the point that you made. You and I, and even our Dr. Bach, New Testament scholar, knows these details about early Christianity, but how many Christians? I mean, not many Jews know them, but we're not supposed to know, I guess. But how many Christians know about this early stuff? Know that there was no guy, you know, named Matthew who was one of his apostles, but actually this thing was written, you know, 70, 80, 90 years later. I thought your point, Bob, was really good, which is, yeah, they teach them in these seminaries, but then the preachers come out of the seminaries and they don't let their flock know that there are real questions here. I mean, that's what Dr. Bart Ehrman found. He found, he believed every bit of it, and then he studied it, and he's like, oh, wow, ooh, questions, ooh, I don't know about this. And the Christian ministers don't usually tell their flock the truth about early Christianity.
No, and frankly, it's not because, and this is the sad part, and this is what makes it so miserable for me, is when you realize that the reason they're not telling the flock about it isn't because, well, on the one hand, they do say, you know, a lot of the people who are coming here just don't have, and this is a bigoted assumption that they make, just don't have the brain power to dope this stuff out.
They should give their flock more credit, honestly.
People are smarter than they think they are. But the other side of that is that if you start smartening up the chumps, and that's their viewpoint, not mine. If you start smartening up the chumps, then the next thing you know, you're not going to be building any cathedrals anymore, because it leads to an existential examination of things. And suddenly you realize that you don't need the guy in the cheap suit at the front of the room anymore. Because you realize that within a Christian tradition, that you are responsible for your own salvation. Now, your tradition, as I understand it, doesn't quite work that way, because you're not leaning on the rabbi to tell you what it is. You're leaning on the rabbi to help you learn for yourself what it is.
That's right. And you're supposed to have your own opinion, and you're supposed to disagree with the rabbi. And if you don't disagree with the rabbi and you just sit there and listen to him, you're not a very good student. And they will criticize you. Why haven't you challenged anything I said? What kind of student are you?
And see, this came up in the horn section last night as Peter and I were talking. You cannot raise your hand during the church service and say, brother, what do you mean by that? Or, brother, I disagree. God. Or, brother, pastor, you're wrong. Willard Romney's talk about how religion needs freedom and freedom requires religion, it's actually within Christian sects the exact opposite. There is no freedom if you are not doctrinaire.
And we interrupt each other all the time.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I interrupt you so much.
But if you're not doctrinaire, if you're not dogmatic, if you're not orthodox, there's only one word for you: heretic. And you got to get out. There's no freedom. It's one of the things that I think we need to bear down on a little bit is that for all these goomers who think that the roots of American freedom lie in the Bible. That's just bunk. It's just pure, unmitigated bunk, especially in Christianity. I mean, you can point with...
There are some roots to freedom in the Bible. I'm not going to completely...
Maybe in your half, but not in mine.
Let me give you one in my half, because I think it's actually a very beautiful passage. It's the point where the people are coming together and they're telling Prophet Samuel they want a king. And he's like, a king, he's gonna ruin you, he's gonna take your women, he's gonna take your crops, he's gonna make life miserable for you. And the people are like, we're afraid of the Philistines, we want a king, damn it, Prophet, give us a king. And so Samuel goes and he gives them a king. And then the kings go and they tell the prophet, ooh, I want this guy's vineyard. I want this stuff. And the prophets have to tell the kings, sorry, you're not the divine ruler. You're just a king. You're just a man. This is God's law. You have to follow it too. The idea that the head of a country, even a king, is not perfect and still has to follow some law, that's very much a part of my tradition and a very proud part of my tradition. So I don't want to completely say that democracy, I mean, I realize it's not pure democracy, but the idea that the king is not all-powerful, that there are checks and balances, if you will, does come, some of it, from the Hebrew Bible, and I'm very proud of that.
But by the time you get to Paul, for instance, he's telling the churches, or at least the letters that are ascribed to him, because I can't do chapter and verse on this right now, so I'm not sure if it's one of the four that we agree he wrote, but he's telling them, you know, look, if Caesar's there, Caesar's appointed by God. And you know, you got to do what Caesar says, because he was writing not during the persecutions.
The right, he was writing to persuade the Gentiles rather than.
Writing to persuade the Romans that the Christ sect was okay. We're not going to cause you any problems.
Exactly. No more revolutions here. Don't worry.
Slaves, don't gripe about the fact that you're slaves. Eat day by day, live on hay, and you'll get pie in the sky when you die.
Yeah, no, that's very contrary.
And so there is no concept of individual freedom inside the New Testament. The only reason we got the American experiment is because of the Enlightenment writings of, you know, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, that crowd.
And the Magna Carta. I mean, some of the British experience.
Sure. But even that was structured within a royalist model.
Right.
But the idea of individual freedoms and individual rights doesn't come out of the Bible at all anywhere. That comes out of the mind of enlightened man.
I don't want to say it doesn't come out of the Bible anywhere. There are human rights. I mean, look, there were slaves in the Bible, but you have to treat your slaves better than anyone else.
But they're still slaves.
Yeah, they're still slaves, but you got to give them a rest day, and you got to... I mean, look, I'm not saying this is... slavery's good by any stretch, but there were advances for its time in human rights in the Bible. Women are clearly not equal in the Bible, yet they have... There are stories about women and they're actors and they are moral agents and things you see in the Bible where you find other writings of the exact same period of other ancient peoples and women are simply property. So it was for its time, I think, in advance, and I'll give it that without in any way denying that it didn't go near far enough.
But I don't hold that
against...
Call
me apologist if you will.
No, I don't hold that against the religion. I hold it against the culture.
Right, for saying
that. I hold it against the unenlightened human beings. One of the things that I have to look up and remind myself, I'm fond of my genealogy and stuff and knowing where I come from, but I think I mentioned this in a conversation with Susan a few weeks ago. I have to remind myself from time to time that I would not like sitting down and breaking bread with anybody more than maybe two generations back in my lineage, because they were mostly barbarians.
Well, even two generations back, your grandfather was not the nicest guy in the world.
No, he was a wonderful man, but, you know...
It's not so nice to black people.
But there aren't any here. That wasn't what that was about, but he was still a member of the Klan. I mean, there weren't that many black folks around here. It's not what they were operating on. They were basically a vigilante force, period.
Hey, Bob, before I go today...
You get the idea. Yeah, we're enlightened, they weren't, yeah. But go ahead.
Well, I just, I did all this studying for today's show. I had no idea where this was going to go today, and unfortunately, I think I wanted to give him a chance to speak. I didn't want to interrupt him too much, but at the same time, I wanted to cover all this material. It was a very ambitious goal that I didn't get to finish. There are two more passages, just real briefly, that I want to throw out to people, at least give you my perspective on these things.
Absolutely.
And one day, if we ever have Dr. Bach back, we can ask him these things. One thing that I think is very interesting is what Jesus says on the cross. What I was going to ask Dr. Bach is, what language was the New Testament written in? The answer, of course, is Greek. What language did Jesus speak? The answer, of course, is Aramaic. People who think he spoke Hebrew don't really know. No, they spoke Aramaic. It was the Hebrew of the day. It was the language that Hebrew had changed over 1,000, 2,000 years. Anyway, they spoke Aramaic. And what's very interesting to me in the New Testament is there's extremely small part of it that is still in Aramaic. I mean, literally maybe 20 words in the whole New Testament is still in the language that Jesus spoke. And some of it is not even interesting. You know, they called him rabbi. Okay, fine. So, but to me, the most fascinating, which is an Aramaic word, but to me, the most fascinating thing is he's on the cross. The poor guy's being crucified, you know, nails, the whole thing. I mean, bloody mess. And what does he cry out in Aramaic, in the language of the original? If there's anything to believe in the New Testament, we have to believe this, because, heck, it wasn't even translated. He says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? By the way, he doesn't say Father, Father. No, no, no. He says, my God. He doesn't claim to be the Son of God. He just says, God, God, what are you doing to me here? I'm stuck on the cross. I'm being crucified. Why are you forsaking me? In other words,
well, isn't that a quote from Psalms?
It is. It is. We've had a lot of trouble in our history, as you talked about, and so Jews are constantly crying out, "Hey God, why have you forsaken me?" But what's interesting is it's almost blasphemous. Here's this guy talking about God will always be with us, and then he says, when he's in a time of extreme distress, admittedly, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And what's interesting to me is that is a very, very human reaction. It is the reaction of a man who believes in God to the day he dies, is suffering gruesome pain, horrible torture, and is crying out to his God, to his Lord, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's actually, you know, Job wouldn't have done this. Job would have just taken the treatment. But he's saying, God, God, where the heck are you?
Well, see, there are those of us who argue, Mark, that is the moment when the light finally goes on for Jesus.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very human cry and not something that a God would cry, but something that a real human flesh and blood who believed in God his entire life and then got a raw deal of is crying out to his God. And to me, that's a very human thing for Jesus to say. And one thing I wanted to ask Dr. Bach was, why the heck would a God who's planned this sort of elaborate pretend-to-die kind of scheme here where he's not really hurting and he's not going to really die anyway and it doesn't even hurt him any, which raises a whole other question. I mean, a man dies for your sins, but he's not a man. He's a God. He doesn't suffer. What kind of sacrifice is that?
Well, that's what I was trying to get at. The human Jesus is inspiring.
He is. There's no question he is.
But you're right. There's no need for a God to cry. That's like saying, why have I abandoned I?
Myself. Why have I abandoned myself?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. I'm God. My God. My me. Why have I abandoned me? Why have I forsook myself? I just don't see anyone saying that.
No.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
No,
so that's
it
one
doesn't.
Point I wanted to raise. I didn't get a chance to, but that's okay.
But it's so very true. And I don't know, maybe it's tough for some people to hear this.
It's in the original Aramaic too. Yes. I mean, if there's anything that we know the New Testament got right, it's got to be the few things that weren't translated into Greek. I mean, this is stuff, there's something in the law that we lawyers know about called excited utterances. And basically in the law, you can't have a witness on the stand say what somebody else said because that's hearsay and that's bad and that's not trustworthy. But if you heard an excited utterance, if someone shouted fire or rape or whatever, that's allowed in because in evidence in the law, when someone screams out in pain, you know, we can believe that they're probably not faking it.
Well, so, we can believe that they're actually saying it because it's a reflection not only of the speaker, but of the response of the auditor as well.
Right. You would have remembered it because it was so strong.
You know, if I touch a hot skillet and I scream, oh, F word.
Right.
The speaker is not offering my exclamation to prove that I was engaging in the F word.
Right.
They're offering it to prove that I uttered that in extremis.
Right, and so that's another reason why, to me, the very powerful Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me, is indeed very strong evidence to me that there was a guy Jesus, that he was crucified, that he was in utter pain and agony, and that he was a human being who cried out to his God and then died a gruesome death.
And see, and that's the point in time where Jesus begins to matter for Saul of Tarsus. Okay?
Yeah, I think you're right.
because
before his martyrdom, he's just a guy with a man with a plan.
Yeah. And you know,
like so many at that time.
For anybody who has never seen it, I'm not offering it for its historical truthfulness or anything like that, but just for absolutely three thought-provoking hours, The Last Temptation of Christ is absolutely brilliant. I was told going into the theater I'd go to hell because I was going to see it, you know, stuff like that.
You know, I thought it was a good film myself.
And it's the second half of the movie that really, well, no, the whole thing is just amazing. It's just because it's a human Jesus with, you know, if you believe in prophets, if you believe in people to whom the universal power reveals itself from time to time, then it's an interesting window into sort of the apprenticeship of a prophet. And the question of what it actually means to be the Son of God, because you know your half of the book speaks of sons of God too early on.
Many of them, and there are many of them, and indeed the children of Israel are supposed to be sons of God, and that actually segues into the last point I wanted to raise. I didn't get a chance to with Dr. Bach, but it kind of answers Alan's question. Alan asked about a human being dying for the sins of others. And as I said, traditionally that was animal sacrifice. But there is a passage in Isaiah that Christians go to all the time. It's Isaiah 53. And it talks about God's suffering servant. And Christians universally attribute this phrase to Jesus. And what's interesting is that the Jewish people have always said, who is God's suffering servant? We say with all due immodesty, heck, that's us. We've been the ones that had been persecuted for thousands of years. The Jewish people have been serving God and suffering because of it. We are the canary in the coal mine of human history when we are the people who die for other sins. Now, you may say that's a very arrogant and presumptuous thing to do, but that is how Jews have traditionally treated Isaiah 53. And to read from Isaiah 53, you know, surely he has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. He was oppressed. He opened not his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. Indeed, many people discussed and said that the Holocaust victims who didn't cry out were led like sheep to the slaughter. It's just very interesting that for the Jews, the idea of God having suffering servants, which is not anyone serving God and suffering for it, and I would argue in my personal belief, it's not just the Jewish people, but really anyone that is suffering because of their trying to do good in the world. But all of this, to us, very much applies to people throughout the ages. And the one person who it doesn't apply to is some divinity that fakes his own death. It would apply to Jesus if he is a man, but actually, if he's a God, Isaiah 53 couldn't apply to him at all. And so that's the other thing I wanted to bring up with Mr. Bach, and I didn't get a chance to, but I wanted to say that here.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. The last words of Gandhi, you know, what is it? Lama in Aramaic?
Means why.
Okay.
Lama means why.
Oh, okay. Gandhi's last words are Rama, Rama, which of course is God, God, unless I miss my guess. So there you've got Jesus saying why, but you know he's addressing it to God.
Right, Eli means my God. Yeah. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Oh, okay, so the first words were God, God.
Yes, it was. Eli means, it's actually my God. Eli, El is God, and E, that form at the end, means my or me. That's why sabachthani ends in an E too, because that means my or me. So it's my God, Eli, lama, why, and then sabachthani means forsaking me. Why are you giving me up? Why are you abandoning me?
Oh, Mark Levine, you know what? If we could get a good-sized circus tent and be a little bit less existential, we could be rich beyond our wildest dreams.
That's scary. That's really scary.
No, because that's what happens. You take a person who has a greater than normal understanding of this kind of stuff. You put into the mix an understanding of human psychology and a willingness to prey on it, and then you put on a soupçon of larceny, and you've got an evangelist.
We just don't have the soupçon of larceny, Bob. We got to work on that because we need more money for the
horn. Well, that's what I said. You know, because you know the existentialism is the most existential people in the world are the Creflo Dollars and Joyce Meyers and Benny Hinn's. You know, I think you know, you said it would be good for it would be good for people to learn other faiths. I would, you know, I would recommend that people actually avail themselves of the opportunity to watch some of these people operate, these hucksters and these charlatans, so that they will have a better understanding of what is being done to a certain portion of our population, how it's being done, and what impact it has on them, because those people leave the... Well, it ain't tents anymore, Mark. It is rock and roll concert arena-sized megachurches with 50-foot jumbotrons. All right?
Have you seen the movie Jesus Camp, Bob?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because that does exactly... Let me just recommend to anyone who hasn't seen it. That movie describes exactly what Bob's talking about it in detail. And it's easy to watch. It makes you mad. It's actually really, really good documentary. You can rent it anywhere. Check it out, because that is it. That is it. Bob, I got to go because
yes,
I had
do.
A holiday party. I was supposed to go to
that's right. You live
ago.
In civilization, don't you?
I do. And so I really should attend that. But I've enjoyed this very much, and I'm glad I did it. And I hope no one was offended by it. And
I can't imagine that anybody was, but this was an absolute joy. I love doing this with you every now and then. And let's see. So you know what? You're not here tomorrow. I'm not here Monday.
Nope.
Enjoy your extremely long weekend, and I guess I'll talk to you on Wednesday evening.
No, I'm.
Oh yeah, you're gone. Oh yeah,
I'm gone. I'm off. This is my last. Actually, I am doing just a TV show, which you can get on the internet at RadioInsideScoop.com. That's going to be Sunday at 6:30. It's going to be a very light show. We're going to be reminiscing and kind of going behind the scenes at the television show to see what folks do there.
Lots of visuals, so I probably ought not run the audio, right?
Yeah, you can if you want. No one. I don't think
anything
else.
Let's see that again.
Well, no, hopefully it won't be all visuals. We're gonna have a lot of sort of oral reminiscences of things that happened. If it's not on the horn, you can catch it at RadioInsideScoop.com. But then that's it for me for 2007. I'm coming back January, whatever that is, 7th or whatever, in 2008, and there'll be lots more of the Inside Scoop.
And somewhere on a sunny beach, the rays will be beaming down upon you.
That's true.
Remember us here in the frozen world when you're sitting there with something in an umbrella in the top of it in a coconut shell and living the large life.
I will try to think of all the little people, Bob.
That's all we can ask.
Happy New Year to everyone. Merry Christmas if you celebrate it. A belated Happy Hanukkah. A Merry Kwanzaa coming up. Happy holidays. And if I forgot your Celtic holiday or Druidic, Ramadan's over. Whatever it is,
Solstice,
everyone
Mark.
At the Horn family, I love you very much. And thank you, Bob, and I'll see you next year.
As we do you. Take care, Mark. Wow. Time flies by when we do these things. It really does. And this last hour, your conversations, your phone calls, if you wish, a few minutes before we head to the top of the hour as well. And, I've, of course, the horn section and Peter Godbold, Strictly Confidential, coming your way at 9 p.m. Eastern. You know, we've done a lot. We've spent a lot of time on religion this evening. And I enjoy it. Like I said, there's an element of it that's pure intellectual masturbation, and you know, it's fun. But there's also there's also reality out there that is always lapping around the screen door like a, you know, the lupine pest. And we have given in recent days a pretty good workout to Reverend Mac Hoekstra. and to the exclusion of some other freaks. And I would hate to be thought to just, you know, being myopic in my focus on these monsters on the Republican side. So I do want to let you know, last night we talked a little bit about the Nationalist Movement of Learned Mississippi that are complaining that they have to do everything that everybody else does in the way of obeying the law so that they can march on, these people, white supremacists. Boy, don't they prove themselves an oxymoron when every day of their lives. So they filed a federal lawsuit in Gina, Louisiana, to try to keep from having to pay the fees so they can march on Martin Luther King Day. And one of the people who thinks like they are, not a member of the Nationalist Movement, but no, this guy is a member of the White Patriot Movement, a member of the White Patriot Movement for 30 years now, a man by the name of Don Black of West Palm Beach, Florida. I can hear Peter Godbold now. Not Florida again! Yeah, Florida. Don Black of West Palm Beach, Florida, thinks very highly of Ron Paul. He says, we know he's not a white nationalist. He says he isn't, and we believe him. But on the issues, there's only one choice, and that's Ron Paul. We like his stand on tight borders and opposition to a police state. He likes him well enough that Don Black has given $500 to the Ron Paul campaign. When the Ron Paul campaign was called on it, the Ron Paul campaign said, hell no, we're not giving the money back. A spokesman for Ron Paul by the name of Jesse Benton said, and I quote, Dr. Paul stands for freedom and peace and prosperity and inalienable rights. If someone with small ideologies happens to contribute money to Ron, thinking he can influence Ron in any way, he's wasted his money. Ron is going to take the money and try to spread the message of freedom. And that's $500. This guy's got to do, has to do whatever it is that he does that he hasn't got to do it with. You remember how the right-wingers used to scream and continue to scream about people who give money to Democrats? A decade or so ago, you couldn't turn on the radio without hearing Rush Flush Flimball having an on-air aneurysm about, who was it, Charlie Tree. And more recently, an absolute right-wing hissy fit about a man named Sue, really. With all due apologies to Johnny Cash, who had given some money to Senator Clinton and had some legal problems of his own. Meanwhile, over in Republican land, though, if you just happen to be a white supremacist, and if you just happen to run a website called Stormfront, yeah, you've heard of this, whose motto just happens to be White Pride Worldwide, and welcomes postings on their message boards to the Stormfront white nationalist community, well, that's okay. I don't see Dr. Paul taking a lot of grief about this. Nope. He's going to use it to preach freedom. See, this is libertarian excuse making. He's going to take the money and try to spread the message of freedom. Because, we're libertarians. And libertarians believe that all money is good, no matter where it comes from. Money is sinless. It's just pure. And as long as we're using it to spread freedom, it don't matter where it come from. Yeah, keep telling yourself that, why don't you? So in the next hour, like I said, we'll carry on some conversation A little bit of audio coming for you from Dear Leader, if you haven't heard it yet. Oh, that'll be fun. And right now, the news. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to the voice that you make happen. All the programs on the horn. And we'll be back after the news.
In his feet, but nothing in his back. He's the boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa comes to town every Christmas. He lives up in the mountain like a hermit in a cave. He never had a haircut and he never took a shave. He's the boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa will boogie all. A candy for your song. But when it starts to boogie, the whole town rocks.
This is the Quality News Network. Amidst police batons and pepper spray, New Orleans City Council members unanimously approved a controversial plan to tear down 4,500 public housing units damaged by Hurricane Katrina. A crowd of demonstrators tried to get into today's meeting inside New Orleans City Hall, but were kept out by local police using pepper spray and stun guns. Several legal challenges to the proposal have not been resolved. A CNN poll released today shows the top three Democratic presidential candidates in a dead heat in Iowa just 2 weeks before the caucuses. Leading the Republican slate is former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, followed by former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is in third place. Congressman Tom Tancredo has dropped out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination and thrown his support to rival Mitt Romney. Doctors treating Rudy Giuliani have given him the all-clear to return to New York after he spent the night in a St. Louis hospital. Giuliani was hospitalized late last night with flu-like symptoms. A year-long battle over the federal budget has come to an end. President Bush both admonished and praised Congress for passing a $556 billion spending plan. Mr. Bush complained this morning that lawmakers had wasted time and taxpayers' money, scolding Congress for stuffing 9,800 special interest projects into the budget plan, which also includes an extra $70 billion for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The U.S. military has announced last week's discovery of a torture complex once used by Iraqi insurgents in the Diyala province. The remains of 26 people were found nearby. The torture chamber had chains on blood-spattered walls and ceilings and an iron bed hooked up to an electrical supply. The discovery was made near the town of Muqtadiya during an Allied military sweep of that area. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger plans to sue the federal government over its decision not to allow the state's current plan to reduce greenhouse gases. President Bush just signed a new car emission bill yesterday, but Governor Schwarzenegger says he wants better for California. And a 6.8 earthquake has struck offshore in northeastern New Zealand. No deaths reported in connection with that shaker. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
You know you can depend on QNN for honest news. Now we want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea on California's beautiful Central Coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple clicks and you're visiting a website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for: quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, and the best shopping, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
Electronic gadgets are topping this year's holiday gift buying season. Included on the list are notebook computers, digital cameras, and digital picture frames. Retailers say sales of those items are up 500% from last year. In Great Britain, talking on a handheld cell phone while driving has been made an offense punishable by up to 2 years in prison. The Commerce Department reports that gross U.S. domestic product grew at 4.9% pace last quarter. They say that performance is especially impressive given the current state of the country's housing market. The U.S. economy surged over the summer at its fastest pace in 4 years, but then lagged in the last 3 months of this year. But a new rise in jobless claims indicates that the labor market is softening. For the first time in its 80-year history, investment bank Bear Stearns posted a quarterly loss at $854 million, blaming the subprime mortgage crisis for that. In St. Louis, Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft all agreeing to pay a combined fine of $31.5 million to settle federal accusations the Internet companies accepted advertising for illegal gambling. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow up 38 points, NASDAQ up nearly 40 points, the S&P 500 up 7 points. And there's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
You know, I accidentally had the hour two intro loaded when it dawned on me that, wow, the evening's gone. We've only got 1 hour left. Let's see, a couple of things to mention since we won't be on the air Monday or Tuesday, Tuesday being Christmas, Monday being Christmas Eve. Just going to make a long weekend of it and such like. We'll do our Christmas stuff tomorrow evening. No, not tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday. In a front porch sort of way. Little holiday reading for you. As well as whatever else you want to make of it. And then, like I said, we will be in reruns or something on Monday and Tuesday, back Wednesday, and just word to the wise is sufficient. Now let's see. Phone first. Hi, who've I got?
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Luke, what's up?
Well, I heard you and Mark talking a minute ago, and you talking about the tent revivals.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, if anybody wants to ever read the good stuff about that, I'm not sure who put it out, is to go read some of the biographies of Sam Kenniston.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what, remember, Sam was a tent revivalist.
Yes,
that's
he was.
He came from.
Raised in the Pentecostal tradition, the whole ball of wax. That's what, you know, that's, but then again, that's what made him such a wonderful entertainer because.
Well, it was. When he came out of that, he told the truth about some of that too.
Sure he did.
But people didn't want to have him tell. Because when he would do interviews, he would tell them, that essentially, some of the stuff was just set up,
Yeah.
So I just heard y'all talking about that, and that's all of a sudden just clicked. I remember him one time doing one of his routines, and he was showing how he did that. I remember him doing a 60 Minutes interview back when he had done that. It was just, I say, he'd about have you on the edge of your chair, because he was good at it. But he was really talented.
A lot of his humor was very irreverent and came from that tradition. His whole bit about how you knew that Jesus wasn't married, just thinking about it puts me in stitches.
Oh, I tell you what, there's some of his stuff I wish, I don't know how much of it's out, I wish all of it was out. Some of it was just so funny. I feel every once in a while, if around Christmas time, they show the Married with Children Christmas with him playing the angel.
Oh, yeah. Man. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bless it. You know, barring the fact that people just rot when they die, if there's a heaven, I'm sure he's in it.
Okay, let's go on to some other stuff. Have you noticed, though, in the last week or two, we know about Tweety Bird, but everywhere they want to talk about, well, Mrs. Clinton's numbers in this state are down and this state are down. Isn't it amazing to know how her national numbers stay the same, but there's no talk about the fact that Rudy's national numbers have been dropping like a rock.
Oh, Rudy's dropping like a paralyzed falcon.
I mean, that's his national numbers. That's not state to state. That's his overall numbers.
Yeah, and, well, the other thing is, I guess it's the Rasmussen polling people.
Mm-hmm.
They have come out with some new data showing that Brother Mike Huckstery is only at 49% of the strychnine swilling snake handling vote. He had been as high as 68%, and this is a dramatic drop.
Well, you got to wonder this weekend if anybody's going to actually even dare to mention the Newsweek story about young Mr. Huckstery.
Won't be touched. Neither will be the firing of the Arkansas state trooper who was getting close to filing charges. That won't be mentioned either, because you see, Mike Huckabee is a Republican. We'd only need to do that if he was a Democrat.
It's so interesting to see how this thing's playing out. It's like I said, I sent you the thing today, Mr. Lyons' article this week, his comment, column. And like I said, he was telling you the human side of Hillary that you never get to hear anybody report.
Yeah.
He's talking about his wife and when they're I believe they're.
Oh, but they certainly didn't. There was certainly no problem in circulating that photograph of Senator Clinton looking a little the worse for wear.
In the middle of probably about a 30 mile an hour cold, icy cold wind, which none of us would look very good in.
No, cold will bring out the less than pretty in you.
Uh-huh.
Flush Flemball had an absolute orgy on the air over it.
Well, the thing, though, I love the one that somebody said on that, said, let's put it this way, if all you have to do is take a look at a picture of Rush and say, Rush should never talk about anybody's looks.
Yeah, how true. How very, very, very true.
I mean, it's like, Rush, was your face on fire and somebody used the shovel? Come on. But, no, it just amazed me, though, like I say, that the fact that, you know, state to state, that's going to happen. You know, I mean, right now they're talking that, in Iowa, it's a three-way tie, pretty much, and the Democrat, as the polls show. Now, who knows what it'll wind up being.
And, you know, it's a caucus process, Luke, so anything can happen.
It depends on who shows up.
Yeah, it depends on who shows up, but it also, it's because it's a caucus process, if I understand it correctly, one of the really important things is not who your first vote is, but who your second one is.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I thought was interesting was, I heard one of the pundits last night. It was one of the ones on MSNBC, but it was, I can't remember which one it was. It may have been Isikoff or, you know, whoever it was. And they were talking about, well, if Mrs. Clinton doesn't win in Iowa, it's not going to look good for her. And I'm sitting there going, okay, what happens if Obama comes in third? Is it going to look good for him? I mean, what happens if it turns out it's Edwards, Clinton, and Obama in that order? You know, because a lot of Obama supports young people, and the way they've got this thing set up, it's going to be right after the first year when a bunch of young people may not be in Iowa.
That's true. They home for the holidays, college break, that kind of thing. Yeah,
heading south to find warm weather.
Well, there's that too.
But you know what I mean? It's just amazing how, well, if Mrs. Clinton doesn't win, it's an awful thing. But well, if Obama doesn't win, well, that's okay. You know, it's just amazing to watch. Like I say, just watch the cattle mentality of the mainstream press. That's like, well, Obama can come in third, that's still not going to really hurt him.
It's interesting. You should mention the mainstream press. I've got a little piece of, we're going to have a little poetry corner here in a minute, Luke, that'll speak exactly to that. Our good buddy Clyde over at WD40.com has written a genius little piece of poetry.
And one other thing, I'll get out of here. But one thing, have you mentioned anything about the apparently little party they had in New Orleans today?
Oh, you know, I don't know how to address that.
Well, the thing, when they're talking about it, they were showing some of the people camped out in this park across from City Hall, One thing they didn't mention in the stories I've seen is the fact that at the end, I think it's tomorrow night, they're closing that. They're throwing those people out of the park. All those people who've been camped there because they had nowhere else to live.
Right.
That apparently, I think it's tomorrow night, they're closing that park. They're putting up fences and throwing the people out, because I heard the story on NPR about a week ago where they were talking about some of the charity groups, you know, they're trying to find people, places to stay. And they were talking, like I said, you know, like the weekend, the Friday before Christmas, they're closing the park and throwing everybody out.
Nice bunch. But
and here they are tearing down 4,500 houses. 4,500,
and replacing them with 477.
And the thing is, it didn't go into great detail. I'm just sitting there going, well, what about these people? Have anybody that's living there, do you have places for them already set up? Or are you just saying, get out, we're tearing it down?
Oh, they've forbidden people to come back to them. It's amazing. And frankly, I'm surprised that there weren't any killings today.
Well, that's like I said, they came close.
Well, it's so ham-fisted and obvious, Luke. This is ethnic cleansing. It just is.
Well, you saw the thing, Representative Moran made that comment about Baghdad, and he's right. I mean, Baghdad has become a city of enclaves, and you're not of that group in that area. If you're in northeast Baghdad and you're a Sunni, get out, because the Shiites own from 5th Street to 25th Street, and if you're a Sunni inside there, they'll kill you. But nobody tells you that's the way that Baghdad has essentially redrawn itself. You know, they say people said the violence is down. It's like, yeah, because they've killed everybody in the zone that wasn't of their party.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And their faith.
And yet, but yet the violence is up. It's on an uptick.
Yeah. No, Bob, you're reading those numbers wrong.
Well, yeah, I know. And I'm also reading the story wrong where the survey results came out that said a vast majority of Iraqi people see the United States occupation as the single biggest impediment to them getting their act back together and becoming a sovereign nation. The funniest part of all that, though, was the military response. Did you happen to see that, Luke?
Mm-mm.
The military responded by saying, this is a very positive sign.
Well, the thing I heard tonight, they were talking about some of the people, you know, who'd worked with the Americans, that they were essentially having to relocate to America because they couldn't live in Iraq anymore. You know, there was one guy, he'd worked with the USAID, and essentially he got the note saying, stay here and die. So him and his family have had to move, and now he's getting into the U.S., hallelujah. But, you know, they don't talk about the fact that all these people, you know, probably millions that are living now on the border in Syria and Lebanon are being told, you know, y'all are running out of money. You're going to have to leave. That means you got to go back home. Life's going to get real fun then.
Yeah, but, you know, the dear leader says that he is a spreader of goodwill. Oh, he spreads something all right.
Yeah, and you better have on hip waders when you walk in it.
Lord, yes. Lord, yes.
Well, I'll let you get on. I know you've got other stuff to do, and I hope you and yours have a happy holidays, because I tell you what, I thought about this today. You know, if you say Merry Christmas, that's okay, but you're demanding I respect the Christian religion if you say that.
Yeah.
So how many times do you say Happy Hanukkah? I love all these people that, like, you know, the big giant head who demands you have respect for his religion, but amazingly enough has no respect for any other.
Yeah, and, you know, Happy Christmas Kwanzaa Danica is just a little bit too much of a mouthful. Happy holidays.
Covers it all. I mean, you know. But like I say, if anybody else says Merry Christmas to you and you don't want to get into that fight, just look back at them and go, Happy Hanukkah. Welcome.
Yeah, but then again, be careful who you say that to, because as Susan noted earlier in the program, that can get the snot beaten out of you on the subway in New York, apparently.
Depending on what you are, you know, for Happy Kwanzaa.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I'll just be glad when they're over. I mean, I'm sorry, that's very Grinchly of me to say.
Oh, no.
But, you know, from Thanksgiving to New Year's, nothing gets done.
Well, as I say, normally what takes me about a 5-minute drive tonight took me about 30 minutes, because, like I say, everybody and his brother's out driving. He's like, no. Like, I go shopping from now on, I'm going to have to get about 5 in the morning and go.
Oh, yeah.
There's no time the roads are clear.
Yeah, or try to hit the places that are open 24 hours and do it at 3 a.m.
Best time to do it. Just after they start. Do it about 5, because they're just done stocking and starting to clean up.
Got it down to a science, do you?
Hey, I've learned if you go about 5, anywhere from 5 to 7 in the morning, you're really usually pretty good. After 7, they start filing in.
I love 3 a.m. Krogering.
Well, if I say, if you wait till after 5, they're pretty much done the restocking, so they've got all the pallets out of the aisle.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, no wait for the checkout clerk, nothing. You know, just get in, get out, get done. Always get a close parking space. Yeah.
Well, you have, like I say, if I don't talk to you again, you have a happy holiday.
And you too. And best of luck finding somebody to replace Trooper Taylor.
Well, I said the thing that surprised me was he went to Oklahoma State. I thought he was going to go to Baylor.
Well, I know. But go figure.
Well, like I said, I'll just be busy for the next couple of weeks talking on that. So.
You take it easy, Luke.
All right, you too.
Bye now.
Bye.
No, I said a little poetry corner for this evening. I checked with Clyde over at WD40.com, D-U-B-Y-A-D, the numerals 40.com. The real night before Christmas. You're going to love this. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and across the land, look out! It's Matthew's hormonal gland. At Greta and Rita, we were forced to stare. Of Natalie's plight, they nightly did air. There's a war on Christmas, O'Reilly has said, with portions of hummus and flatbread he uses in bed. There's Sean in his jackboots, and Ingram in his lap. Poor Alan Colmes still comes off as a sap. In studios at once they all did chatter. They call this debate. Is there anything sadder? With fury and spittle their teeth did gnash. Forget principles, they're in it for cash. Of Cheney and Bush the scandals did grow. When asked to report, they said, oh, hell no. With Paris or Brittany, there's no need for fear. There's time for real news sometime next year. For now, it's the story of the pretty white chick. And there's always the story of Falcon Michael Vick. The studios are different, but the talk is the same. They bristled and shouted and called them by name. Now Crystal, now Gibson, now King and Blitzer. On Beck, on Grace, on Scarborough and Tucker. With viewers and ratings, your numbers did fall. Can't you tell by now that we loathe you all? On issues of import, the people did try, yet busy were you with the airport bathroom guy. Defense of Limbaugh, of course they flew like DeLay, Rove, and Libby, too. Attacked Kerry and Durbin for their verbal goof, yet with Savage and Coulter, they remained aloof. Ducey and Kilmeade, the alarm they did sound of Obama's real faith. They thought it was found, wrapped in the flag from head to foot, while victims of Katrina, still clad in ashes and soot, like wolves in a forest, they travel in pack, ready to stab a Democrat right in the back. Bush lies go unchallenged. Cheney's crimes, how many? The story of Terry was better than any. Lou Dobbs and Cavuto are having a row. It's the fault of the immigrants. Or didn't you know? Republican talking points is what they bequeath. The Democrats outnumbered 3-1 seat. Their arguments are foul and smelly. Serves as the fare upon radio and telly. Put the war and its death upon the shelf. Instead, let's talk some more about that teacher MILF. No mention of soldiers shot in the head. Would much rather blame liberals instead. The truth not needed for this type of work, if spoken on air, is removed with a jerk. The lies into war must lay in repose, for it's time for commercials. This segment is closed. Free speech for all is from the Constitution, they say. but only as long as it is said their way. The show is over, and the host says goodnight as he flips you off upon dimming the light. Yeah. Beautiful work, Clyde. I didn't know you were a poet. Now, of course, you know that Vladimir Putin has been named Time's Person of the Year. I know, but he has been. And that's, you know, Time always has this caveat. Now, this does not indicate that it's a monetary prize, and it's not an endorsement of anybody's actions. It's just who we think was the big person of the year. And, of course, it came with a certain amount of irony. And what I mean by that, well, I had to, I get my notice every day from our good friend, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, over at Finnerman Works. Vladimir Putin is feeling sentimental today. Today is the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Cheka, the first Soviet secret police. In honor of this special day, 90 journalists will be assassinated. To make that quota, the corpse pile will have to include 4 movie critics and 7 cooking columnists. Russia's running out of journalists. We tend to think of Lenin as a misunderstood old dear, just a badly tailored Edmund Gwinn. Of course, that's only because we're comparing him to Stalin. In fact, Lenin wasn't that old, a mere 47 at the time of the November Revolution. Now don't you feel like you're an underachiever? Nor was he remotely lovable. Although he was not a Stalinoid monster, Lenin was a certifiable creep. He was an obsessed, remorseless tyrant who actually read calculus books for fun. Would you be any less dead if Lenin shot you for the sake of dialectic materialism than if Stalin shot you because it was his hobby? So it wasn't surprising that Lenin would establish a secret police just 6 weeks after the November Revolution. So much for the honeymoon. The first head of the Cheka was Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was unique among the Bolshevik aristocracy in that he really was an aristocrat. Anyone who slighted him at a soiree or beat him at tennis probably didn't live to regret it. Dzerzhinsky may have betrayed his class, but not his tastes. In the midst of revolution and civil war, Dzerzhinsky requisitioned a Rolls Royce for his personal use. It should be noted that his timing was as impeccable as his style. He died of a heart attack in 1926 and thus avoided a less natural cause of death from Stalin. In organizing the Cheka, Lenin was just observing a hallowed Russian tradition, since Ivan the Terrible, the Tsars, had relied on secret police as well. Indeed, Ivan set the standard, his death squads, the Oprichniki, had a very distinctive insignia, the severed head of a dog on their saddles, again with the dead dogs, for heaven's sakes. Who knew that Ivan the Terrible and brother Mike Huckabee's boy had something in common? Maybe there's something to this reincarnation business after all. The dog's head presumably would sniff out treason. Ivan had distrusted his nobles, and the Oprichniki eliminated the causes of his anxiety. Of course, even the Oprichniki found that Ivan could be a little too whimsical. There's a story of a father and son team who had risen high in the Oprichniki hierarchy. While at a feast, Ivan thought of a test of loyalty for entertainment. The son was ordered to strangle the father. Before the guests, the son complied. Then Ivan ordered the son to be executed. After all, how could he trust anybody who would kill his own father, huh? So, the Oprichniki evolve into the Okhrana, who were the Tsar's secret police. They were specialized in suppressing the growing radical movement. They proved so successful at it, Eugene notes, that at infiltrating revolutionary groups, that the Okhrana agents actually were managing many of the revolutionary plots. 1911, Okhrana actually oversaw the assassination of the Russian Prime Minister Pyotr Stolypin. a political moderate, at least by Russian standards. Stolypin's attempts at reforms outraged the conservatives. Oh, there they are, the conservatives again, always making trouble. So Okhrana manipulated a thoroughly infiltrated radical group to kill him. The actual assassin was a genuine revolutionary, but his supervisor and his supervisor's supervisor were all in the Okhrana. The Okhrana even infiltrated the Bolsheviks. One of their double agents was a young Georgian lad who called himself Stalin. We can surmise, says Eugene, that Stalin only gave up the names of the people he didn't like. Of course, that could have been enough to crowd Siberia. Oprichniki, Okhrana, Cheka, KGB. Oh, the happy memories that Vladimir Putin is enjoying today. Who says you can't bring back the good old days? Not Eugene Finerman at FinermanWorks.com, FinermanWorks.com. If you're not getting your RDA of irony, I can only wonder why not. 29 minutes past the hour. To the phone we go. Hi, who have I got?
You've got Jim.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good.
Well, Ivan the Terrible was slightly demented in many ways. You know, he was quite a... I don't know exactly how that boy grew up, but he had some bizarre things happen to him. And initially during his reign, before he lost his wife, that they thought was... her death was caused by poisoning. He was reasonably moderate, and then after that, he sort of lost it completely. And he would gravitate between periods of extreme cruelty, and then he would go into a monastery. And at this monastery, they did all kinds of terrible things. And then, of course, he would spend hours on his knees begging forgiveness from God. And then, in a state of rage, because of his daughter-in-law's dress, he made a comment about it, and the son defended his wife, and Ivan killed his own son.
I thought that was Yvonne.
It was, yes, it was. He was one of the more terrible dukes of Muscovy, and yes, he did have the Oprichnina, and they did have black side. They wore black, and they had hoods, and they had the dog's head, and they had the broom across their saddle, which was a sweet plan of treason. And unfortunately, that's just the way things went. And of course, you know, Lenin said, without terror, there is no revolution. And that's exactly what he meant. And a lot of people would like to remember Lenin as being this avuncular old gentleman who loved to play with cats and Gorky and stuff like that. But he was a pretty bad sort, too. A lot of people like to lionize Trotsky. Trotsky was a pretty rough character, too, until he was sort of thrown out by Stalin, because Stalin knew it was either him or Trotsky. And, of course, Trotsky wound up in Mexico City in 1940 with Alpenstock through the back of his head. And
although it's quite interesting, I forget what particular field it is. His granddaughter is doing, I think it's groundbreaking work in neurological science.
I just saw the film last night, The Assassination of Trotsky, with Richard Burton and Alain Delon and Romy Schneider. It was pretty good. Going back to Arkady Stolypin, who was the prime minister who was doing good things for Russia, the assassin was Morgan Bagrov. And he could have been some type of double police agent. He was shot in the Kiev Opera House. And, of course, the Tsar said they always kill the good ones, the ones who try to help you. And I think Count Beckendorf was the one who was ahead of the Okhrana at that time. And that's always been sort of a cloudy thing, because I don't think that Nicholas would have killed Stolypin, because Stolypin was his ticket out of there, was his ticket to a liberal, democratic, humane Russia, because he was really making things work for him. And with the death of Peter Arkadyevich Stolypin, I mean, good Lord, have you ever seen the pictures of Stolypin's house when they tried to blow him up with a bomb?
No.
There were 32 people in the house, and they were killed. Luckily, he wasn't, but the house was completely destroyed. I mean, you know, the People's Will and the Narodny, those people were just, they were terrorists, and they were determined on bringing down the social structure anywhere they could. They didn't care whom they hurt, bad or good. And it was a very sad thing. And Jesse Schenko once wrote a poem about his own country, and he talks about the incursions of Russia, of the Varangians, of the Tatars, and he ends up by saying, and our own people, more terrible than any of these above.
Well, there's an there's an element, it seems, and it's all, it seems to always have been in play in Russia, Jim,
but without
that, enjoys watching stuff come apart.
Well, you know, without the Czechs, the revolution would not have survived. Without the NKVD, the Zorodny Komissariat, the new Yell, Stalin wouldn't have survived. And the NKVD and the all the other KGB things that, you know, basically came after it. But still, you have people today who reminisce of the days just goes to Stalin. They would say, if only Stalin were here.
And well, and generally, I mean, there's apparently a significant portion of the Russian people today who reminisce for just, you know, plain old Soviet Union, whether it's Stalin or Brezhnev or.
That's when they were a nation that destroyed the earth like a colossus. The days of Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin and things of that nature, and, you know, but now they're making their way back, and you know.
Well, some would argue that Putin is now taking them backwards, though. So,
well, he's taking them forward in many ways because there are a lot of Russians who do support and agree with him. But you know, being on the cover of Time doesn't make you a Nobel Prize winner. You know, Adolf Hitler graced its cover several times.
That's true.
And so there it is. There you have it. By the way, I did hear your minister or the theologian earlier.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed very much what he had to say.
Well, he's out moving a book right now called, I forget what the title of it is, but it's basically a response to the people who have gone into the textual criticism business. I thought the first hour was fascinating, but I thought he sort of, Mark put it well, he sort of filibustered his way out of some of the tougher questions.
Well, I've heard old people do that stuff, Tim, Bob, and you know it, and I know it.
Oh yeah, well, you know, and the thing is, if that's your line of work, sooner or later you're going to wind up doing it.
Well, whatever, but you know, the basic thing is this, and it comes down to the very simple thing: you either believe it or you don't.
And that's precisely the word. You believe it. You don't know it. You believe it.
Faith is something, as I said to you long ago, it is a leap into the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, personally, I believe it. I believe in the virgin birth. I believe in the things that I've been taught. And I'm not going to ever change my mind on that.
Nobody's asking you to.
That's just the way I feel. And,
yeah.
You know, I have a right to that.
I can't go along with it because I live in a rational world that rejects stuff like magics and zombies and people getting up from the dead. And
Bob, do you really think this world in which we live today is totally rational? No, it's not.
Rational? Rational? No. Not rational, but I think it is ruled by
the world.
It is ruled by natural laws, Jim.
I don't know. Yes, it is, but I'll tell you, there are all types of interpretation of natural law, and I'm not going to debate that with you because I know your feelings on the subject, and I didn't call to be contentious.
Oh, I understand. I mean, I just, you know, it's what I've been trained in, and it's.
Well, I've been trained in things too.
You know, Boyle's gas laws don't have any miracles in them.
Well, I'm talking about the flux of humanity and the things that are happening in the world today. And as I said before, there is a great deal to be said for a lot of people, and I'm talking about the people you don't like the most, the right-wing fundies and things like that. Regardless of whether I know you don't care for these people, and I realize how you feel about them. I've heard it for years. But they're going to continue to believe the way they believe because they want to believe it, and that's just what they accept on the basis of faith.
And nothing I say is...
That's hard to defeat.
I'm not trying to defeat it, Jim. I'm not trying to defeat it in the least.
Argue against it really is, and sometimes I think, and I'm just want, you know, sometimes the more you try to argue with these people, and the more you try to debate with them and undermine their belief system, the stronger their belief system gets.
And that's fine.
The wider the gap between you comes.
They're welcome to it. There is no more jealous advocate of the First Amendment than I am. The nature of my argument is not with what they believe, but with their desire to force that belief on everybody in this country. And they do maintain that desire. They're not happy simply to worship in their churches and in their homes. They want to tell you what kind of holiday greeting to offer. They want to tell you how, you know, who can love each other, who can marry each other. They want to tell you how disease is to be treated, what science is to be accepted and what science is to be rejected. And on that front, Jim, I'm going to fight back with everything that I've got. I don't care what they believe. It's less than not caring. I'm utterly disinterested in it. However, when they try to make it a function of public policy, that is when they've reached, that's when their rights have extended past the bridge of my nose.
Well, I don't believe in theocracies either. I never have, and I never supported that.
And you're also a student of history, so you know, as such, you've got to be at least a little bit intellectually indignant or offended by their attempt to rewrite it and make, for instance, the framers of the Constitution into people that they were not.
Well, I can understand that, too. However, we still live in today's world. We don't live in the world of 1789, and we live in a world in which our country is sharply divided, and these people control a great deal of power and access to power.
No, I won't dispute that, and that's part of the reason
100% of all the Republicans are fundamentalist Christians, 40% minimum. I was reading that in Time magazine yesterday. There was a study done on that.
And that's all the more reason for me to encourage progressives, liberals, decent people to oppose these folks, because you take the might of the United States, and Lord, it's a lesson that we have been long and painful in the learning, Jim. You take the technological and treasury resources of this nation, and you put it's like putting a gun in the hand of an infant.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is this: the only way that you're going to correct or remedy that situation, in my opinion, is to have people who are of more moderate persuasion, for lack of a better term, being voted into office. And I really just don't see that happening with certain strategies that are being pursued. I just don't see it.
Well, the other thing that's disturbing out of this process, Jim, is the fact that on the Democratic side, and heaven knows on the Republican side, there seems to have developed some need to subvert to subvert honest rationalism and bow and scrape to these people. I don't know why the Democrats do it, because they are not going to vote for a Democrat come hell or high water, because they've been told by the guy at the front of the room in the cheap suit that they'll go to hell if they do it.
Well, I don't know what they say to the Democrats, but I will say this, and I'm going to get off here because you have your own program to continue. I can remember back in the initial stages of 2004, of the election year, and that's when Gavin Newsom made his move with the make gay marriage thing. And I said to myself right then and there, I said, I wish he could have waited till 2005, because now they're going to use this thing to beat John Kerry about the head, and they did, and it defeated him.
Well, it wasn't just that that defeated him, though, Jim. I mean,
but that was the beginning. That, you know, even in January, and I believe in John Kerry. I mean, I gave the man $1,000. I believe in him that much. But when I heard Gavin Newsom start that stuff, get elected, reelected mayor back in San Francisco, I said, if only could he have waited. And my position is simply this: to get into power, to be voted into power, and then you can do your work, and then you can equalize things. But you can't do anything when you're on the outside looking in. You've got to be pragmatic.
No, believe me, I understand. No, I don't believe in poking these people with a sharp stick in the middle of an election year either. I know what you're talking about there, but
that's exactly what happened.
But there's also an element with which I'm very sympathetic, and that is, if not now, when?
Well, you simply have to wait, and all things come to those who wait. If the question of patience, he wins who waits. And you can't get what you want, and they say all or nothing. Well, when you say all or nothing, you're going to get nothing. I can guarantee you, historically, you're going to get nothing. Hitler said all or nothing. You see what he got? He got it, didn't he?
Yeah, but you can't equate Hitler with people who just want to get married.
Well, I'm just talking about people. I'm just talking about strategy, belief systems, and belief strategies. I'm not talking about their components. I'm just talking about their strategy. That's all. And sometimes I believe in what Henry said when he became King of France. Paris is worth a mass.
I understand the meaning of that. I do.
Okay, buddy.
All right, you take care, Jim.
Merry Christmas to you.
All right,
bye
thanks.
Now.
Bye. Okay, and rolling onward. Let's see, who have we got? Okay. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Carla.
Hey, Carla, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm calling from Clearfield, Utah.
And exactly, how are you this evening?
I'm fine. I liked your comment that you told to your daughter yesterday about Jesus' birth. I have always thought that, too, you know, because, you know, but no one wants to study that possibility.
Oh, no, it's a third rail, Carla. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things. Did you imagine you talked about the commercial of Huckabee?
Yes.
With the cross?
Yes.
In the background? That was a little on the offensive side, you know, to me. I thought it was a strange commercial. And then I've heard the commercial on the radio about Giuliani's commercial about, you know, there's a guy, he's talking about something strange, and then Santa Claus comes up and says, ho, 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 ho. It's just another strange one. Have you heard of that one?
I haven't seen it, Carla, but all the Republicans have some version of something along these lines, and they're all trailing after Huckabee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is offensive,
yeah.
And the, you know, the premise of Huckabee's, I've got in the habit, I can't not call him Huckabee. The premise of it is so dishonest. I know you're probably getting tired of all these commercials, especially the political ones. Well,
mm-hmm.
There he is in a political commercial telling us that. What a con. What a fraud. What, you know, what a little three-card Monty game. If you understand that people are getting sick of political commercials, the remedy to that, Carla, would seem to me, take the political commercials off the air.
Right.
But not one of them would do that.
The other thing I saw, and I believe I probably, it's either on whatreallyhappened.com or buzzflash.com, that Huckabee never really got a degree in theology, you know, even though he's calling himself a minister and probably did it, but I didn't check it out, so I don't know the source of it.
Oh, so his degree may be a fake?
Yes, If I find where I found it, again, I'll let you know.
Oh, please do. I'd like to see that.
Okay, I have a very slow computer, and it's given me fits. So I need to have your address so I can send a donation to you.
Oh,
it to make out the check to head on.
Right, the physical address is 1038 North Eisenhower, just like the president, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, next line, PMB.
Three, like a boy?
No, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, B as in boy.
Okay.
318 stands for personal mailbox.
Uh-huh.
Beckley, Beckley.
West Virginia, I've been there.
Yep.
I've been to West 100 years ago.
And the zip code is 25801.
25801.
Right.
Okay.
And we certainly do appreciate it.
Okay. And I'll try to send a little bit each month, so because I really appreciate you the work that you put into your broadcast, and it just keeps me sane, and it helps me to sometimes go to sleep at night.
Well, you know, if I can help with the sanity part, that's fine, and you know, if I'm putting people to sleep and it serves a purpose, I guess that's good too.
Oh, well, yeah, but then it's, that's okay. But there was a guy the other night. He was on a tangent, and he was, I thought, what planet is he on? But I forgot who the guy was. His name Jim?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know which one you're talking about, but it could
you
be. Tangents are our specialty, Carla.
Yeah. Well, that's what's nice about your program, because you do let the other person talk on his tangent, whereas the other talk shows, they cut you off, they yell over you, but at least you give people a chance to voice their opinion, and I think that's important in this day and time, because, you know, our choices are really very slim, because you don't get enough news on your alphabet soup or your cable. You get more and more of one view, you know. And
oh, Carla, you know, I mentioned that they changed the cable lineup on me here and left me with nothing but Fox News. I got to tell you, before that, you know, I'd go in and take a peep at CNN or something, or MSNBC, something like that, or when the opportunity presented itself on the rerun, watch Keith Olbermann. But for the most part, I got to tell you, I don't miss television news, because there wasn't any, what I realized in its absence, there wasn't anything on it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And today I saw, and it was on, I believe, either Brian or Katie's show, they had a one of our veterans on there that had come back. You know, he was proud to serve in the military with two tours. And then he cracked because his best friend died, and he, of course, you know, blames himself, because I guess when they were doing a checkpoint, this young man that was killed, you know, took Sean's turn, and so when he got, you know, so he died, and Sean came back, his parents noticed a big difference in him. And he kept saying, you know, it's my fault, it should have been me, and should have been me. And what's tragic about this is, you know, he's thinking about, you know, he knew something was wrong with him, and he was contemplating suicide, maybe hurting somebody else. And he went to Fort Hood Hospital there and got caught up in your bureaucracy. And then his father and mother took him up to a place, I think a VA hospital in New York, and they diagnosed him with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
And then the military didn't like that, and you know what they did? They discharged him without any medical benefits.
Oh.
And so now the guy is trying to, you know, take his, you know, he's probably going to take his case somewhere, you know, legal, because I thought, how tragedy this is. You know, they're in there, they're in combat stress, they're not getting any breaks, and then they come back, and people in our Congress just ignore that. It is a big problem, and I just don't see the veterans, the VA, doing a hell of a lot to help these people in, you know, with the Vietnam veterans. Even they, just like they brought up the report about a week ago of the suicides. And, you know, and it's like, well, it's just, you know, oh, you're just wimpy men. You can't take this, you know.
And there's an entire culture of that within the military.
Mm-hmm.
People who know that, you know, on the one hand, if they, there's a separation questionnaire, if I understand the process correctly, Carla, where when they leave the service, they have to go through a debriefing,
mm-hmm.
and someone in the medical arm says, you feel okay? Been having any nightmares? Having any trouble sleeping? Seeing anything? Are you jumping when you hear a loud noise or anything? And the soldiers understand that as long as they go, no, 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 I'm just fine, then they'll go through to separation, and they get to go home, and then they're done.
Mm-hmm.
But if they say, you know, I can't sleep, I've got nightmares, I scream in my sleep, I do jump at loud noises, I'm a wreck, then there's a whole different layer of misery to go through, and they get tagged as, you know, it's a very macho culture, and they get tagged as somehow defective or flawed, and they view it as, you know, life goes downhill from there.
Mm-hmm. And it delays them, and all they're saying that, you know, they're going through this process that a lot of times it's not explained to them correctly, and all they really are wanting to get home to see their families. You know, that's all they want, you know, to do, and so they're saying no, 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 and then the stress, you know, comes in later. It's just like if you lose a loved one, it doesn't hit you right away. It may come a week later or something like that, because you have those stages that
right.
you go through. And you know, and we've got a government, and it has to be Congress, both on the both sides of the part of the aisle, and our president that doesn't care doodly about them. Let's just go over there and kill, kill, kill.
And that is the bottom line, isn't it, Carla? These soldiers are toy soldiers to him. They're little things that he moves around on a game board map.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no getting around it, because if that was not the case, he would have acted in a different fashion.
Yes. He's not a true Christian either.
Not by any stretch of the imagination. Not
and
even a little bit.
Yesterday they had that hearing, and they were repeating it today, of the Halliburton, the young woman from Texas.
Yes.
That was held in
raped and then kidnapped and basically held in isolation. She had to convince one of her captors to loan her a cell phone when she and called her daddy. And her daddy called his congressman, a Republican congressman in Texas.
I just listened to her story. Now she's 23. This happened to her. What, she was about 20, she's had to have reconstructory surgery on her breast.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess in the Senate, when they were having the hearing for another Scalia intern, the new deputy attorney general, that Mark Phillips.
Right, right.
Senator Whitehouse brought up another story, and he said that Senator Nelson down in Florida had another situation, you know, with one of his constituents, the same, I guess, she worked for Halliburton, and according to Jamie, there's about 11, at least 11 people that have complained.
And it's all been swept under the rug. And you can't tell me for an instant, Carla, that somewhere along the way, somebody in the Bush administration didn't hear about it.
Yeah.
You can't not know these things. Do you know what I'm saying? You can't not know it. You can't avoid the knowledge of it. Just like you can't avoid the knowledge that we were torturing. No matter how many times you say, we don't torture, it's still torture. And he knew it. And because they authorized it. They demanded it. They created it, Carla.
Yeah, and then on the torture deal, there was this, he's a bald-headed general. And I can't remember his name. Oh, well, you know, with the torture, but I don't really consider it torture. And they were just showing some pictures of the Guantanamo people. It was a story on the three British people that were just released, and then they get back to England, and they're they put them into jail. They had been over there for 5 years. And they had gone on a hunger strike, and they had put him in this restraining chair. And military person, it doesn't, you know, it's no real big, it's a little discomfort, but it's no big deal. You know, when we force feed them, we put a tube down through their nose that goes into their stomach. I have done that procedure when I was going, you know, through some NCO training.
Yeah.
You know, to be a LPN, and I had to do that.
It's not easy, and it is unpleasant.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, if you don't get it down the right way, it could come out your ears. I had to do that. And some guy he didn't have to do it.
Yeah, I don't mean to laugh about whoever's having it done, but just the idea that wait a minute, this isn't supposed to be coming out of his ear.
I know. Yeah, that's what I said. And when it's done to you, because we had to do it to each other, it's a very uncomfortable position. And that chair looked like what they did years ago. I said all they needed was a cap on top of their head, and they would, you could suffocate or be electrocuted, you know.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And then he says, this stuff is no big deal. Oh, now look, we go in and talk to them, and we sit them down on the couch and everything. And one of the detainees said, yeah, and I got blinded in one eye by the pepper spray that they put in. I mean, we are raising or are training our troops to be psychological killers.
Yes, indeed. Carla, I hate to say it, but we're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I enjoy our conversation.
All right. Have a happy holiday season.
You too. You too. Take care.
And put up your holiday tree.
we've got our holiday tree up.
Okay.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And tomorrow night, the holiday edition, I suppose, we'll call it that. A little reading and a little of whatever you care to bring to the program. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
This is the Quality News Network. New Orleans City Council members unanimously approved a controversial plan to tear down 4,500 public housing units damaged by Hurricane Katrina. A crowd of demonstrators tried to get into today's meeting inside New Orleans City Hall, but were kept out by local police using pepper spray and stun guns. Legal challenges to the proposal are pending. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is suing the federal government over its decision not to allow the state's current plan to reduce greenhouse gas vehicle emissions. President Bush just signed a new car emission bill yesterday, but Governor Schwarzenegger says he wants better for California. Meantime, the White House wants a dual strategy to combat global warming. According to President Bush this morning, a two-pronged strategy is needed, bring other countries to this table, and develop a national plan. Bush says he opposes the Kyoto Protocol because China is not a participant. Mr. Bush says a national plan is needed, but he won't compromise the American standard of living. A year-long battle over the federal budget has come to an end. President Bush both admonished and praised Congress for passing a $556 billion spending plan. A CNN poll released today shows the top three Democratic presidential candidates in a dead heat in Iowa 2 weeks before the caucuses. And leading the Republican slate, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, followed by former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is in third place. Congressman Tom Tancredo dropped out of the race today for the Republican nomination and threw his support to rival Mitt Romney. The House Intelligence Committee issued a subpoena for Jose Rodriguez, the former CIA official who ordered the destruction of secret interrogation videotapes of two terror suspects. Rodriguez will face the committee on the 16th of next month. Meantime, the CIA says it will turn over documents to Congress about the destructions of those tapes made during interrogations of Al-Qaeda terror suspects. The Pentagon has announced plans to increase the Army by 74,000 soldiers, adding six new combat brigades to major bases in Colorado, Georgia, and Texas. And a leading South African prosecutor says there's enough evidence to charge the country's newest president-elect with corruption. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Huell Hauser talks to customers of First National, South Valley, and San Benito Banks, local members of the network of preferred community banks.
We're here to talk with people about their local banking.
So what do you look for when you decide where you're going to put all your millions?
Well, I haven't printed up enough to put it in the bank yet, but I guess for convenience and... Pretty much, it's like your grocery market. You get to meet the people there, and you build a little rapport with some of them.
You know, it's a local bank, but it's part of a network of local banks that give you big bank services.
Everything that I need as far as banking is concerned, they have it. Online banking is great for me. So I just like the services that they offer.
You ever taken your dog Cindy to the bank?
As a matter of fact, when I went to open my account, she was with me.
Ah!
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we have a horse come through one of these days. We got a lot of cowboys coming in and out of here, too.
Above and beyond.